Start recording. We'll start the recording here. Hello and welcome. This is Dr. Rita Marie Lascalzo, and we are here for our rounds call for insulin resistance solution practitioner training. This is our fourth call. It's actually our fifth call because we inserted a bonus call in the middle. But this is our fourth official rounds call. And I want to start off by giving you guys an opportunity to share and ask any questions that you have so far. What I hate to do is just pile on more content before you've had a chance to really fully absorb and ask questions about anything that you're stuck on. And what we can do is do that at the beginning, and then I'll open it up at a couple of different points throughout the presentation just to make sure as we go through and do a little bit of a review. Tonight's call, I wanted to go through the fifth of our major categories of changing, and that is timing. And I have some slides prepared for you, and this slide presentation will be up available on the web. Afterwards, you'll have copies of the slides, you'll have copies of downloadable version of the MP3, and we will have a bunch of resources for you, and I'll let you know what those resources are. So anybody that has, if you're on the web and you have a question, go ahead and type it in the Q&A box. As usual, the Q&A box is over to the right. And actually, it's over to the left. I'm a little bit backwards today. It's over to the left, and it just says questions, and you'll have a box, and you can type in your question. And if you have a question and you're on the web via the phone, go ahead and do a star.
The moderator has left the conference.
Okay, so I'm not coming off along. I'm not coming on as me, Beverly. I'm coming on as a Moss Beach, California number because I'm calling from a friend's phone, and I got disconnected. So hopefully I'll get back on. I couldn't get in on my cell phone. It kept telling me I needed a calling card. It's very, very strange. So as I was saying, when I started to get bumped off, I was watching and I saw myself go away. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. As I was saying, is that I want to start off with one of the processes we learned about last week. We actually learned about it earlier on, but we really went into the details of it last week, is heart math and what I call our mini vacations. And this is an amazing technique for you to teach your clients and patients, and you're going to find that they can actually start to control their blood sugar levels by engaging in this process. It's pretty amazing. It's actually more than amazing. It's almost magical, if you want to call it that, because it can actually bring down blood sugar. I've seen it come down 100 points within a few minutes. And, you know, that's not the typical, but the typical is to be able to bring your blood sugar down 20 or 30 or 40 points in a very short period of time if you really, really get into this activity. The reason I want to do it right now is I need it. I had a very stressful day getting here and driving here and getting my computer set up and having some technology stuff. So I just want to make sure that I'm here 100% for you guys and 1,000% for you guys to answer your questions and provide you with the next steps in helping your clients and yourselves, quite frankly, get over your insulin resistance. Because quite frankly, a lot of people have it that don't even know. And if you get this stuff into practice yourself and you can get yourself on a steady keel, you are going to be the best teacher because you teach well what you most need to learn yourself. So let's all sit in our chairs, you can either fold your legs under you, lotus style, or put them flat on the floor. Put one hand over your heart, the other hand over your belly. And then just go ahead and take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you breathe, breathe as if you're breathing right into your heart, bathing your heart with clean air, oxygen, fresh reoxygenated blood. Just allow yourself to feel that. And as you breathe in the next time, activate a feeling, a really deep heart feeling, feeling of love and appreciation. And you might be able to do that by just thinking the thoughts, love and appreciation. Or you might need to reach for some sort of a memory or visualization of a place that you love, a place that brings you joy and peace. Or a person that you love that brings you joy and peace to be around. And just get that feeling. Go back into that scene or go forward into that scene if it's something that you're imagining and visualizing and scheming towards. And just be there. Actually put yourself there. The beauty of our brain, our nervous system, a magnificent nervous system, is that it can't tell the difference between you faking it and really making it, so to speak, between you remembering in vivid detail or visualizing in vivid detail a scene and actually being there. And you can evoke the same wonderful chemistry, the same balance in blood sugar and hormones that you could if you were indeed there. So trick your brain and learn this well so you could teach your clients. Because like I said, it's nothing short of miraculous. HeartMath.org has plenty more details even. And the 30-day stress transformation tool that I gave you. Don't gloss over this. Take it seriously. And if you haven't gone to Module 3, go there. And learn this well. So just pull up that beautiful scene, gazing into a lover's eyes, looking out over a sunset, holding a newborn baby for the first time, stroking a pet as it lays in your lap, filled with unconditional love. I'm going to the beach, and actually, I am about a block away from a beach, Half Moon Bay, California. So I will probably get to go for a walk on the beach later. I'm so excited by that. So I'm ready to be back with you and share with you some new insights, some more details, answer your questions, help you to take it to the next level, help you to get to the point where you own this material, where you feel so confident in teaching it that it just comes naturally and flows. Because you've seen the magic of the transformation that it can have. And then just take a couple more deep breaths and then open your eyes. And come back into the room, ready to learn, ready to grow, ready to have some new skills that you can take into your practices right away. Okay. So, let's begin. And if you have any questions about anything we've covered so far, go ahead and raise your hands. If you have any questions that you want to type in about anything at all we've covered so far, go ahead and type it in the Q&A box. And I'll just begin before I check the Q&A box for questions. Just begin by letting you know that one of the bonuses that you had for this program, or one of the big parts of this program, is that you get to experience the Before Be Gone program with me, which helps you, which helps takes people through a balancing of their blood sugars. And this coming Thursday, we're having a call, basically a preview call for it, to let people know what that program's all about and invite them to participate. Some of you received as a bonus a free entry into the program for one of your clients or family members. And you should have either today or will tomorrow received an email telling you how to activate that bonus. Registration for the program is going to open on Thursday. You guys automatically are registered. You might have received an email to that effect so far. And you will, it starts officially the following Thursday. So people will have about a week to think it over and decide whether or not to join. So you're welcome to share that information. Invite your own family members or friends and clients to that call on Thursday. And if you register as an affiliate through our affiliate program, then anybody that you refer into the program, you actually will get a bonus. You'll get a nice check from us. So it's a nice way to build, you know, build some extra income into your practice, is to find programs that you really believe in and help people to get registered for those. So if you need to know how to get there, you could just go to my website, drritamarie.com, and click on the affiliate sign up button on the upper right. So we have Beverly has her hand up. Beverly, hi.
playing with the unmute there. Yes, hi. I have a person I'm trading some service with, and she called me today, and she's a 70-year-old Parkinson's patient, and she's on levodopa, L-DOPA, some drugs to help her with tremor and so forth. And she's hates vegetables. The only thing she'll do is juice. She makes a juice that has all greens, or mostly like vegetables that are green, not so much leafy. She will put kale, I think, in it, and carrots. So she does really well on that, apparently. She also has had a gastric bypass. Mm-hmm. And she is finding that she gets a lot of low blood sugar, and she's convinced that that means she doesn't have a problem with her blood sugar, which, of course, I educated her about that.
Right,
and
right.
She's getting shaky and sweaty, and her numbers are really low. And she goes, I have a problem with keeping my blood sugar up. I said, no, you're spiking, and then you're dropping, and you're suffering from the effects of going too high and then dropping. So she, because of the bypass, can only eat every couple of hours.
Yeah, that's a different situation,
Right, and so I'm not quite sure. She also is insists that she, because she hates vegetables, she loves cheese and rice crackers. She's a huge dairy fan, and she loves that egg white protein. I've tried to get her to try the other protein powders, the hemp, she's never tried chia, so we're going to try that one. But all the others, the sprouted proteins and the hemp, and said she's never done well on any of those. She feels awful. And the only one that's helped her is the egg white protein from, like, Rob, somebody,
Jay
Rob or something like that. And I'm not quite sure where to go with her about getting her balanced because of all the despise of vegetables, and trying to talk her into, you know, how to help get her on a healthier diet. She loves cheese. I'm going to try to get her on the dairy alternatives, the nut.
Is she open to that?
She is, and so that's very exciting. So I'm thinking I can get her to do the yogurts and chia gel, and those will help her a lot.
Right. You start with where they're willing to start, and then you just increase a little bit at a time. You said she can do juices, though. You mentioned she'll do the juices.
Yeah,
right at the beginning,
she'll
you said
like
there
a
was a
celery,
couple.
Zucchini, cucumber. She'll make a juice. She loves to do juice. And
okay,
she'll
so
do
get her
that
doing that on a regular basis. Get her doing the chia seeds. Get her to do, I mean, obviously she probably is doing protein for breakfast if she's doing that protein powder. And, you know, really focus on getting her off of the stuff that throws off her sugars. Is she willing to test her sugars because that's the eye opener for people. They think they don't have a sugar problem until they start to test it.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to enforce, that it's really important that she starts getting
right.
a meter and testing what she's eating, because she doesn't believe that, you know, the rice cakes could be an issue. They're only 23
right.
calories. They're certainly not a problem. And I'm like, yeah.
Right. Right.
You
know, first thing you might have her do is get her to order through Direct Labs or have her doctor order is the hemoglobin A1C.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just see what it's been, you know. And if that's elevated, that would suggest that she has been having some blood sugar issues, right? If
yeah.
it's very low, then it would suggest that she indeed does have a hypoglycemia problem, which, as we know, is on the spectrum, right? Some people don't have, they don't have the resistance yet, although it sounds like if she's gotten to the point where she needed bypass surgery, she's going to be gastric bypass, she's going to need, she probably does have an issue, right? Because
yeah.
she has a weight issue.
Right.
So it's really the little things. What are you going to get into her psyche and see what you could get her to do? Ads are easier than takeaways, so start to get her to do more ads, right? If you can't get her to do the veggies, maybe there's a green powder that she can mix with something and sweeten it with a nice flavored stevia that would make it taste good to get her a little bit more on the green side. Maybe there's a stir-fry recipe or something you could share that would get her to like, you know, vegetables a little bit more. And then get her, I would look at getting her on some of the, does she have cravings? Does she have blood sugar, sugar cravings and starch cravings?
Well, she's pretty good with that stuff. She found her husband locks up, he has a key to some cabinet that she found, and she says, I'm really good. I had 2 pumpkin cookies in the last, last week. And so it sounds like she doesn't splurge. I'm not quite sure.
Right.
If for her, the biggest, she in her mind thinks she needs to eat every 2 hours and or she can't get by. And so she's so hooked to that cheese and rice crackers. And then she says it's boar's head, so it's good. She's really convinced that she can eat this boar's head turkey.
Yeah.
It's boar's head. Isn't that just all deli meat?
That's all jelly meat. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, you've got a lot of work to do here.
I know.
You've got to start with her understanding how this stuff is affecting her and then being willing to change and seeing that it's going to matter. So, you know, you need some ammunition. And I think if she'll do the blood sugar testing, fine, but at least have her get a hemoglobin A1C and a fasting insulin and a fasting glucose just to see what those are. Right, and if her fasting insulin is high, then she's got a hyperinsulinemia issue, and that would explain the other. And then with the foods every 2 hours, yeah, she's taught that she can't eat too much because she's had gastric bypass. Right, you can't put too much or you'll burst the staples or whatever. Right, so you have to eat small amounts, and it's true. But if she eats more nutrient density in the small amounts, she may be able to go longer. She may be able to manage it longer. Because it's not so much a blood sugar issue that's making her eat every couple of hours. It's just that she just can't eat enough at one
physically.
Meal.
Right. She's got
yeah, she just physically can't. So,
right.
So those are some of the things I would start with. And keep us posted, because it's not an easy case to deal with. You know, the attitude, the head is the hardest part to change. Remember we talked last time on head-heart habits, right? You have to actually, you can't enforce new habits on a belief system that's old. So it's really helping them to see and finding what the triggers are that are going to help them to see that something's got to change.
And the funny thing is she's got a really great sense of a heart bypass too. And
oh
they
boy.
Went back and tested her, and she has no blockages anymore. They said she's got the healthiest heart they've ever seen because she's used heart centered, mind centered meditation and healing with herself. She's amazing.
That's great.
And she's actually clairvoyant and very, she's an amazing person, but she's got these couple of beliefs about the food that I need to
right.
work with her on. And thank God she's willing
right.
to finally come to me and ask these questions. But she's
right.
asking that, and I'm, you know, willing, obviously she's willing to find out what it's going to take to make
exactly.
her feel good. She's
exactly.
working out.
And she does have a lot of things that are pointing in the direction of blood sugar, right? The heart stuff, the obesity, I mean, there's definitely issues that are saying, yeah, you know. So start with those simple things, that like simple blood tests, because it's real concrete. Like, look, your fasting glucose is this, your fasting insulin is this, or your hemoglobin A1C is this, which means that your average glucose is here, and these are the things that happen.
Yeah, the longer term ones are what she's. I want to get her to get an A1C. The hemoglobin A1C, I think, will be an eye opener for her, because she's convinced that every time she's done fasting glucose with the doctor's office, that it's been back 91, 90 something, and 101. And I said, well, those are a little high, but it's not bad. Mm-hmm. But still,
well, it is bad. It's not bad. You know, you increase your risk of heart disease by something in the neighborhood of 3 times. With the number 300% when it's over 90 compared to in the 80s. I mean, so the statistics don't lie. You know, it's on the path. And for some people it might be okay, but, you know, you have to just look at the big picture. Okay?
Right. But somebody with her health history, I was surprised
yeah.
they were that it, low. I'm like,
surprised
well,
that they were that low.
Good. Yeah.
Right,
and she wants
it isn't.
To know if I can help her tremors. Do you have anything that you know of that might be because inflammation, she's asking me if...
Yeah, here, I'm going to stop you right there just because it's off track.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can bring that one up on our ERSPC call because it's more
okay.
in line there. Okay?
Yeah. Okay,
great.
Sure, great.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. I think next we have from David Lotker.
Okay, so we have a question from who?
Eleanor.
Oh, Eleanor. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. Yes.
We always have this thing. I wasn't looking, so she was. I have almost like this conversion program in my brain now to who is who when I see the name. So, right. Hi, Eleanor.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I did a lot of reading, and I have a couple of things I need to get clear on.
And you always have great questions, so I just want to acknowledge you for that.
Good.
You always
thank
have really
you,
good, like
you.
It really shows you've been thinking hard about the material, so appreciate
thank
that.
You. I, you know, in the beginning when I read the guidelines for breakfast, it seems like you could do either a green powder shake, a fresh green juice, or a smoothie. But then when you recommended the day one menu, it seems like you want them to do all three. So I'm not really clear. I mean, do they get to choose from one?
No, they get to choose. You mean in the menu planner?
Yes. Yeah. Like
yeah,
the first
I've been kind
day,
of...
That,
having a little discussion about that with my my program manager on that, and she's kind of an English teacher and has this, you know, stuff about how things should be worded, and the way I say things isn't quite. So I couldn't figure out a way to tell her to put it in. I want them to be able to choose. They could do all of those, right? But I want them to choose. It's the point is to get some really concentrated greens in at the beginning of the day with some protein with the omega-3s, so the chia seeds for most people. But some people don't tolerate the chia, so they'll do flax or hemp or other things. But getting that balance at the meal, greens for the carbohydrates.
Good. Protein. That was a lot to ask to do all three.
All three is kind of, I mean, you'd be sitting there all morning drinking breakfast, so and then you'd be peeing the rest of the morning. So Well, I'll look at that again and see if we could get that.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. And can you add coconut milk to the smoothie, or is coconut milk a no-no on this?
Well, I think it depends on the type of coconut milk, and it depends on how they react to it. So, for example, if you were to make fresh coconut milk with the coconut water from a young coconut in the flesh, for some people that's too much carbohydrate and it shoots their sugar up. For others, it doesn't. But if you're talking like a canned coconut milk or those containers,
so,
those
so isn't it called so or something?
Like So Delicious or something?
Yeah.
A lot of people do really well. I have a couple of people who are super sensitive to the sugars, and they can't eat grapefruit because it shoots their sugar up, but that coconut milk is just fine. So that should be fine. Obviously, we're always looking for the freshest possible, so we want to encourage them to use fresh food rather than that. But those come pretty close, and just get the unsweetened one because some of them are sweetened.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep, that's fine. And coconut, actually, if you recall when we talked about the omega-3 thing, is that the coconut helps the omega-3s in the flax to convert, to elongate.
Be okay.
Actually
I was
really helps.
It would be okay. Good.
Yeah, it's very helpful.
Good. The other thing is you talked about being over 120 as a diabetic, and that you, in one of your tapes, you said it three times. And my client, he started out by just looking at his fasting glucose.
Yeah.
He has days when he's over 120. They're not consecutive 3 days in a row, but, you know, he has 120, you know, one day, then 4 days later, 121, then 2 days later, 120, then a couple of days, 123. I mean, is he there?
Yeah. So here's the deal. Officially, by medical diagnosis, it's three times. It's not three times in a row. See, they're talking three times going to the doctor and having your glucose checked.
Okay.
Right? And that's the official way. For I mean, anything, when it goes over 120, that's, when it goes over 110, we're thinking they have a problem. So is he officially diabetic, and do you want to tell him,
no,
hey, you're officially diabetic? No. You don't want to tell somebody that. You don't want to label people and give them a diagnosis, and then they can proudly wear and live up to. You know what I mean? So I would say, by medical standards, though, if he had gone in on those three or four different days and had it tested and they found it high, then he would have definitely been told. But the problem is with that whole system, right, is like, they wouldn't have known it if he went on some of the random days where he was lower. They would miss it. So you're in a unique position by testing, having him test it to say, hey, this is a problem. We got to get this down.
Yeah,
and when you apply
these
processes, he's going to get it down if he follows it.
Okay, good.
There's no doubt.
He's never been below 109, but then in looking at his blood, it confuses me because I think of the morning as the baseline. And he can get down below that during the day. I mean, he could start off at 109 and get down to 98 during the day. And, you know, one day he was at 89 and he got down to 79 during the day. So is that normal that they would get below the morning baseline during the day?
It depends. Okay. So if the 109 or 120 in the morning is the highest it ever gets throughout the day, then something's going on during the night that's triggering that. Either something he's eating right before bed or a stress that's happening in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So that is something to look at. But if his numbers are just, you know, up and down throughout the day, and he does go higher than that 120 after eating sometimes, depending on what he eats, those lower numbers could actually be a reactive hypoglycemia because it's relative. Right, the reactive hypoglycemia doesn't mean it goes down into the 60s or 50s. It just means that you eat a meal, it goes up, and then it goes down below where it started. And unless he's eating those foods that we've already talked about that help to lower, you know, he's taken a shot, a couple of, you know, berberine pills, or he's taken some extra chromium, or had some of the foods on our list, right, that lower it. But if he's not deliberately doing that and his food is just going up, I would be looking at what was the last meal before that and how high did the sugar go to see if it's a reactive hypoglycemia or just, hey, a good reaction, a good response.
Okay, and one of the things I've been curious about him is sleep breathing. Could that make his blood sugar high in the morning?
Absolutely. Think about that. All of a sudden you can't breathe in the middle of the night. Is that a stress or what?
Yeah, he doesn't have it, but I've been suspicious that he...
Oh, you're suspicious, right. But if that's the case, that's a physiologic stress. The body's always all perceiving, oh, my God, I can't breathe. So that creates an adrenal response. That's a fight-flight response.
Okay.
So the cortisol could go up, and that could cause the blood sugar to be high in the morning. And it's common with people with sleep apnea that they would have high cortisol, high sugars in the morning because they have high cortisol.
Okay, and not good, but that's at least there's a reason because he keeps saying to me, I don't understand, I didn't eat anything for all these hours. Why is my blood high? And I've been you know, talking to him about that, so that's good. And if
How are his glucose is doing at the 45-minute to an hour mark after eating?
They're always, I'm looking at it right now, you know, they're 114, 137, 121, 91,
okay.
So 26.
Yeah, I would seriously be looking at the stress, but also doing the diet things that you know how to do to help them get in balance.
Diet. And I had another person I'm working with that they were very hungry and their sugar dropped all the way down to 70. I mean, is that because they're really
70's
hungry?
70's not a problem. I mean, okay. 70's not a problem. It's when it goes down below that. It depends on how they're feeling, too. So if they're 70 and they're irritable and cranky and they feel like they're going to keel over, then that's an issue. Right, but if not, my blood sugar, if I don't eat for a really long time, my blood sugar goes in the low 70s, 70.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not a problem. It's just a longer period of time. Your body is just, you know, it's just not going to maintain it up in the 80s all the time without fuel.
Okay.
Especially, is this person thin or is it?
No. Overweight, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the last question, actually I just forgot what the last question was. Shoot. I just left my brain. Oh.
Well, if it comes to you while I'm talking to somebody else or answering another question, just jot it down and then put your hand
I
up
will.
Again or type it into the question box.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome, Eleanor. All right. So I don't see any other hand. Oh, I do. Tracy. Hi, Tracy. Whoops.
Okay.
Muted. Hi, I can hear you. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I don't know if this is off topic, but I spoke with a gentleman today who is type 2 diabetes. He's had it for over 35 years. And the last 2 weeks he's had a really bad reaction on his face, itching a lot. So I suggested that he needed to stop all the products because he went from product to product to product. And mm-hmm. it's still itching, and I thought we need to look at what's going on internally. So my question to you is, besides looking at a food journal, looking at exactly what he's eating, I know he said he had suffered with gastritis. Would it be a good idea to start really looking at healing the lining of his gut, like with L-glutamine and maybe doing aloe in the morning? What do you suggest?
Well, is he already off allergens? Has he identified, have you gotten him off of gluten and dairy and some of the top allergens to see if those are issues?
No, and he's never done any food sensitivity tests. Because he was diagnosed with diabetes, you know, over 30 years ago, he thinks he has a great diet. I suspect that it's not. It's not clean, and I won't know that until I get his food journal. But is that where you think I should start, like really looking at that first?
I would start with his journal and also look at his gut health. Like you said, gastritis, what other things does he have, bloating and gas and other indications of leaky gut, candida overgrowth, parasite. You know, there's all sorts of things that could create. And the skin is a reflection of detoxification oftentimes. So if he's really toxic or if his gut is out of whack and it's really could be a reflection of gut health. And also the whole thing with gluten. Gluten can cause a dermatitis.
Okay. My last question is, if you've had diabetes for over 35 years, I'm a little surprised. I mean, can his diet clear that up where he, you know, where his blood sugar is balanced? I mean, because it just feels like he's on medication, so it's just really treating the numbers. It's not, you know what I mean? Like 35 years with type 2 diabetes. I mean, I don't know. I just thought if he would clean up his diet, cleanse his body, reduce the stress, that he could actually have better numbers where he wouldn't need medication.
Absolutely. I agree with that. I've seen it.
Okay.
I've seen people do that. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, the only time when that becomes a problem and doesn't work is if he's crossed the line over into pancreatic insufficiency, which a lot of type 2 diabetics will do, and then they present like a type 1 diabetic.
Okay.
And or if he's been misdiagnosed as a type 2 diabetic. But even then, I mean, if it's an autoimmune, there's a lot of stuff that can happen to help him come back in line. So really it's like you work on all the factors you know are going to keep him in balance. And, you know, you're not promising him a miracle, and it could take longer with somebody who's been that way for a long time. But I know people who've been diagnosed with diabetes many, many, many years ago and get it under control with diet and with the supplement, you know, with all the stuff that we talked about, right? It's not just nutrition.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear by now, not just nutrition. And tonight we're going to talk a little bit more about the timing and how that's the really misunderstood piece and how it can just completely throw off the insulin and growth hormone ratios and leptin and all that and completely mess up the blood sugars.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Let's see if there's any questions on the web, and then we'll go ahead and do our kind of formal presentation for the night.
There are a number of questions on the Q&A right there on the teleseminar.
Yeah, if you want to read them, that would be awesome.
Certainly will. The first question, and most of them is at the beginning about hearing. So let's see, I believe the first question is from Eleanor, and she says, you talk about the value of intermittent fasting. Is there some benefit in to skipping a meal like supper if you're not hungry or it's too late in the evening to eat?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit more about intermittent fasting tonight. And I have a whole really lovely 18-page paper to share with you guys that I wrote with a research I've done on intermittent fasting. So, yes, the answer, the short answer is yes, and the longer answer is forthcoming.
Okay. And we had a question that I did not see about essential oils. She also asked from Eleanor, are essential oils just for taste? Or do they have other purposes?
Yeah, essential oils have a lot of purpose. And in this particular case, like when I recommend, say, in the morning, the peppermint with the lemon, that really helps to just, like, get rid of the grudge in your digestive tract when you first wake up, so it clears things and makes it much easier to absorb things. There's a combination of, like, peppermint and grapefruit and cinnamon and lemon, I believe, that works really well for helping with sugar cravings. And there's a product called Slim and Sassy that has that combination that works really well. So essential oils have a lot of therapeutic value. They do add a lot to the taste, but they also, like cinnamon, for example. While cinnamon oil has been found to be not quite as effective as the whole crushed cinnamon is, cinnamon is very effective for helping with blood sugar balance.
And Tracy says, hello, Dr. Marie. Besides doing the Before Be Gone program, would you suggest focusing on the liver and gallbladder to remove the toxins before adding in the nourishing foods to heal the liver?
It's hard to say. I mean, it doesn't hurt to add the foods because the foods are going to nourish. So if you're going to look at the liver and gallbladder, what are the steps in detoxification? Well, it's removing the toxic load. So that is part of that is the whole diet, cleaning up the diet, getting rid of allergens, getting rid of chemicals and pesticides and all the rest. So that's a big piece is the diet. And then, of course, helping to improve the detoxification pathways. And the foods can do that, and that's an easy way to get people to do it, like adding more cruciferous and things like dill and caraway and fennel and all these things that help to support the liver. And then there's the herbs and things that you could do. So those are all part of a liver and gallbladder cleansing process in addition to other herbs and nutrients. So as far as what order to do them in, I mean, I think each person you can work with and you see what they're open to. A lot of people are more open to ads than takeaways, so I'll do ads first, right? That's what we started out the program talking about. Before you start taking away all their favorite foods, give them things that are going to kind of crowd it out and increase their nutrition and decrease their cravings and get their hormones in balance and their receptors, and we'll talk about hormone receptors and resistance tonight. So, yeah, I think it would be wise to do it all. You know, to start with the foods is easy. It's an easy way, especially if you're saying, well, add some caraway and dill to your food, or add some more cruciferous vegetables, except in your lady's case where she doesn't like them.
Right. And Eleanor says, you say to take Chromium 1/2 hour after you take Synthroid. What about Gemfibrozil, and can you take Gemfibrozil with your supplements and meal?
I don't know what Gemfibrozil is.
Gemfibrozil,
so I know that thyroid is always told that you should take it away from food, so a half an hour before. the rest of your stuff. It doesn't mean it has to be a half an hour. It could be longer after, but you do have to take it on an empty stomach. Are you familiar with that medication and what the rules are?
I don't have all the rules. I do happen to be familiar. It's a low bid type. It's a lowering high cholesterol, high triglyceride, hyperlipidemia, you know.
Okay.
And so basically it's in that category. So I don't know if you've had any experience personally with patients or clients using their Chromium.
No, but I think you have to go by what did the doctors tell you or the pharmacists tell you? What does the label say about its interaction with food? And if that's the case, then if it says you don't eat this right with a meal, eat it a half an hour before, so you just follow whatever those rules are. And that's the reason I say Chromium would be half an hour after Synthroid is if you just don't want to mix them together, but a half an hour is better because that's what basically, quote-unquote, the rules are for taking Synthroid.
Right, right. And I think that generally a lot of times I think we're probably better off spacing out if we have to be on a pharmaceutical, out other supplements just to, you know, not interfere. You don't want to run the risk of pushing it when you don't have to. I mean, give them time to do what they need to do if you have to be on them and instead of clouding their issue, you know.
Right.
Or clouding
right.
their effect. Let's see, also from Tracy, Dr. Rita Maria created a health assessment for clients, but will we have an opportunity to see an example of your health assessment?
I have my health assessment in segments. So you've seen the insulin resistance piece, and if you were in the adrenal program, you saw the adrenal piece. But I have a hormone, because I did them online, and people don't like to sit for long periods of time. And I used to have an 18-page one, which isn't up to date. I mean, I could find an old copy of it, and I'd be happy to share it. But it basically goes through, and I ask about diet, I ask about habits. So I'll see what I have. If there's anything that's reasonable to upload as far as my assessment, that'd be fine. And it would be great if everybody else was sharing theirs as well, because we all learn from each other and can learn. Mine is basically a very thorough health assessment that goes through habits and exposures and stressors, you know, past and present. And we actually share the complete set in the CAT program, the Client Assessment Tools for Holistic Practitioners. And that's a it was like a 14-module or 12-hour or whatever, 14 modules, I think it was the total because we had really 10, but then several of them had 6 parts. But it's a really thorough investigation of how do you do functional assessment. And the module 1 in that is the whole thing on health assessments, like the questionnaires and all the different things that you can include. I mean, if you really want to be thorough, you can have a 30-page document to have people fill out. Most people don't have the patience for that. So you kind of spread it out over time and you know, ask the questions as you go along. But, yeah, I'll see what I can find. If I have an old copy of my the one I used to use that was a Word file, I'd be happy to put it up on the site.
Great. And Patricia from Venice says, the video from 820 through 828 and 95 are not available till after editing. Just want to know if it was going to be available soon.
They are available. They are available. They're totally available right after we do the event. It's immediately available. What's not available is a downloadable version of it, which is like edited and downloadable, but you have the originals there. We don't promise that we're going to do a downloadable editable because what happens is we usually do provide them, but I don't promise them or on target because it takes me a good 3 to 4 hours after I do one of these to edit the videos. And given all that's been happening in my personal life with my broken bones and surgery, I haven't had the time to devote to that. So they will be available eventually, but you do have those are totally available. I would not leave you without them. You also have the audios, which are downloadable, plus all the slides. So all you'd have to do is listen to the audio and follow along on the slides, because really, what is the video but the slide presentation, right?
And another from Eleanor from Miami says, I got my bonus email, but it did not mention the Austin workshop. That was included, right? Do you have a date yet?
Yes, that's included. And the dates for that are January 10th through 12th, I believe, and we are just finalizing with the hotel now and negotiations and trying to get special meals arranged and all that. And we'll be deciding on exactly where it is within the next few days, and then we'll give you the opportunity to register. But, yeah, save those dates, January 10th through 12th, and you all get two tickets, actually. So think about who you want to invite to that to come with you and learn and grow. And it's going to be a really phenomenal weekend.
Yeah, it was really fun last year. It was so much fun. Really phenomenal sharing and information. It was wonderful food. God, just I can't recommend it enough. And Gina from Fairfax says, are you saving these Q&As?
Oh, yeah, they're all posted. If you go to the site, there's a link. There's a bar. Let me see if I can find it. I had it up earlier. It's I think it's at the very top, and it's I can't scroll up on. Oh yeah, I can. Here we go. And it says schedule and recording. So when you go to the home page, just hit on IRSPT on the sidebar. You'll see the second thing over from the left says schedule recordings. Click on that, and you will see a list of all the upcoming calls and all the recordings of these calls. These, and there's also links in each of the parts. So part one will say review the rounds one. And on the part two page, it'll say review the rounds two call. And each of those has a link to these recordings.
And I believe that that is all that we have. Let me refresh one more time. I think that's the last typed in question. But I went to the website and got some questions that were put in, but they may have already been answered in your last call because they're 2 weeks old. We had, I'm sure the one from 4 weeks ago would have been. So 2 weeks ago from Terry D. Was wondering when we will receive our bonus material. Working with a client, would like to explore the menu planner and meal options with her.
Yeah, it's all, yeah, that was all answered and it's all
that
available.
All. So there's nothing.
Yeah, it's all, it's all, it's been available since the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And the last thing that was on that was I was listening to one of the bonus recordings discussing Dr. B's preferred use of iodine, and I do believe you probably had already mentioned 5 milligrams of reduced elemental form of iodine preferred by the breast, ovary, and prostate, and 7.5 milligram in the iodine form preferred by the thyroid gland.
Yep, yep, that's, and actually I'm going to get to meet Dr. Brownstein this weekend. I'm going to a conference called the Restorative Medicine Conference, and it's got a really bang-up lineup, including Dr. Brownstein, David Brownstein, who's written, you know, the iodine books and a whole bunch of stuff, and he's done a lot of work with Dr. Abraham, and then also Dr. Jonathan Wright is going to be there. So some big names in nutritional functional medicine. So I'll be sure to let you guys know on the next call any great new things that I learn.
Fabulous. And there are no more hands up.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So let's
begin
the presentation. Can you guys hear me okay? I've got the thing on speaker. Is it okay? Because it's easier for me to do it on speaker than to hold it up to my ear.
For the entire month.
Sounds great to me.
Fantastic. So why don't you make sure everybody is muted, including you, in case you have some electronics going on in your background from your workers. And I'll go ahead and begin. All right. So we are on our fourth rounds call, and I am excited to share lots of great information with you tonight. And before I begin, of course, I want to make sure that you're aware. Whoops. Are you seeing the right slide? Okay, there we go. Before we begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that this information is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's not intended as medical advice. It's a sharing of my knowledge to you from my clinical experience and from my research, and I encourage you, especially if you are personally under the care of a healthcare practitioner, to make decisions about your own health in partnership with your practitioner. And again, when you're working with your clients and you're sharing a lot of this, I highly recommend that you have a disclaimer like this that you use and have them sign at the beginning of working together. And if you're doing any online presentations, to include this somewhere in your presentation. I personally choose to do it right at the beginning because I want to make sure people are aware. I'm not diagnosing anybody. I'm not giving them a treatment plan. I'm just giving you information based on my experience. Okay. So schedules, this is our fourth call, Monday, September 30th. Our next call is next Monday, October 7th. And then there's a bonus call on Wednesday, October 9th. I'm wondering if that is too many calls in 1 week and you guys would prefer that we postpone the call 5, especially since the Before Be Gone program begins on the 10th, that would be 3 calls in 1 week related to 1 program. I am happy to entertain that and move that October 7th call out later. Actually, that call is all where we're going to pull it all together and help you create a program that you can take your clients through, whether it's one-on-one, whether it's small group in person, whether it's online, to help you to put that together. And in fact, it might be more beneficial if that call was to be done after you get to go through all the Before Be Gone modules, because then you'll see how I do it with clients and you'll have a better idea, and then I can help you to put together your own program. And that's something I want you to be able to walk away from this with, is your own program that you can take people through, whether it's a 30-day, 5-session program one-on-one with people or something else. That's up to you, and I'll give you all the tools you need to do that. So feel free to type into the Q&A box and let me know if you feel like, yeah, that would be much better, it's just too much too soon to do it then. And that'll give you more opportunity to really explore the materials that we're going to put out at the end of this week for part 4, and to pull it all together and then really see it in action and do it in action, do it yourself throughout the Before Be Gone program. And then this week, part 4 will be available at the end of the week of the 30th, and then part 5 will be available when we're ready to do our program. And in fact, the part 5 materials I'd like to get out to you before the call, so you have your worksheets and all when we do the call. So it might be better, absolutely better, to do it later, since I'll be out of town over the weekend at a conference. But I'm totally open to going to however you guys want to work with it. So let's just review, right? We have these 5 parts. Our part 1 was our kickoff, and we went through the biochemistry, the causes of insulin resistance, various testing, and basic nutrients. In part 1, we talked in more detail about insulin resistance, glucose testing, and we got started with fitness protocols. Why do we start with fitness rather than nutrition? People are more likely to do a little bit of movement than they are to change their diet. So, and we talked about like basic little things like burst training and short things that you can have people include. And I gave you lots of information and resources, which we will summarize tonight. Part 2, we went through the nutrition protocols. And there we went through the basics of the 30 days, that what foods they should be avoiding, what foods they should be including. Then we went through the emotions, the stress, and the sleep protocols last week, and really shared with you a lot about the biochemistry of how stress affects blood sugar, how sleep and lack thereof affects blood sugar. We went through a lot of the hormones that actually are coming into play during sleep, so that you can have tools available, and we had a lot of resources on the site. And you have had an opportunity over the last week and a half to review those resources, and I encourage you to bring up any questions again at the end of this presentation or online or on the Facebook group. Part 4 is tonight, Insulin Resistance Balancing Act and Protocols. So we're going to go through the timing, which we didn't talk about in any others, and timing we've alluded to throughout, how important it is to time food. It's not just what you eat, but when you eat it. It's not just when you exercise, but when. Not just how you exercise, but when. And also the timing of sleep versus food versus stress management versus fitness, all of those, when they're timed properly, can really skyrocket the results, and it's exponential results. And then tonight we're going to talk about the act, the balancing, what is the overview of the 30-day program, and what are what's a summary of the protocols in each of the areas: fitness, nutrition, stress, and sleep, and timing. And then our last one is creating your program, which is the one we mentioned a little bit earlier, that we could, in fact, push out a little bit if you need more time and want more time to really absorb this. So let's just review those 5 steps to restoring balance in insulin, is increase your insulin sensitivity. Right. Remember we said we like to increase the sensitivity by introducing some nutrients before we actually change those dietary things that are causing the person to need more insulin. So the second step is then to decrease the insulin need, and that's through eating foods that keep the blood sugar nice and in check and doing some things like exercises and sleep breaks and stress breaks that help to decrease the need for insulin. And then reducing inflammation, a big part of it, and we talked a lot about the allergies, food allergies, and inhalant allergies too, but we mainly focused on food allergies and other things that cause, like autoimmune things, that cause an increase in inflammation and how that devastating that is to insulin receptors. And optimizing fat burning and lean muscle mass building. And we'll talk a little bit more about that tonight as well in terms of growth hormone and balancing growth hormone and timing of your exercise. And then finally, minimizing what I like to call the candy bar eating effect of stress. How cortisol, we went through last week, can actually raise your blood sugar as much as eating a candy bar without all the fun. So when you have somebody who's saying, well, I didn't eat anything bad, but my blood sugar went up. What's going on? And you find out that, you know, they were just screaming and raging, or they go through a lot of road rage, or they're going through some really difficult times, stress in their life, that's having the same effect. Only they don't get to have the fun of eating the candy bar. So we've gone through tools and techniques so far that will help them with that in last week. So remember, what we're striving for is to have a normal blood sugar curve. And you can see by the picture, I've shared this one with you several times. On the picture, you see there's a middle of the road one, and there's a low one, and there's a high one. And you want your person ideally to be between the low one and the middle one. Once you get above the midline, you're already heading towards insulin resistance in terms of the numbers. But you'll see that the curves look very similar in all cases. Right, that they start out at a baseline, after eating they peak at a certain point and then they come back down. Now, one of the variations on this, which is a pathological variation, is that after it comes down it dips below the line, and that's what we call reactive hypoglycemia, and we were chatting earlier today in the Q&A about that. So that's what we're really striving for people, and when they can keep it in that low range and they don't allow their blood sugar to go above 110, max 120, they're decreasing the effect that the blood sugar and the insulin have on those blood vessels. And remember, we talked on our very first module, we talked about how when the blood sugar goes above 120, they're already having the peripheral neuropathy changes. Like, you think that peripheral neuropathy is an end state of like 30 years of diabetes, when in fact it's happening 20 to 30 years before they're even diagnosed in some cases, because their blood sugars are going above 120 and there's a little bit more damage. So by the time they get diagnosed, they're having serious problems. And the same thing with the retinopathies, right? The numbers are between 120, 140, but minimally, you know, absolutely above 140, you're getting those retinal changes that are associated with end-state diabetes. So our goal is to help our patients and clients to keep those numbers nice and tightly controlled, and to learn to do the introspection and the lifestyle monitoring that allows them then to see when it's going astray and remove those factors from their lives, whether it be doing more meditation and yoga and things that keep it down, or heart math that keep the stresses down, or removing certain foods, even some foods that may to other people be perfectly healthy, right? We talked about incidences where people have problems with blueberries. And blueberries are considered a food that help restore insulin sensitivity. But in some people, it causes their blood sugars to go up, and they need to at least temporarily reduce those. So tonight, as we go through the review, I want to share with you, once you've taken your client through a process where they've maintained that really nice, steady blood sugars, they haven't gone above 110 for, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, and they're noticing a difference, and their bellies are flatter, and their brains are clearer, and their energy is higher, then what do you do? Do they have to keep them on that strict a diet for the rest of their lives? Well, for some people, yeah. You know, those people with those genetic, strong genetic predispositions to diabetes or that have been there for a long time. And you know what? It's worth it, right? If they can get their blood sugars down and they can get their body working better and they have to eat cardboard, many of them will say, yeah, I will. Others won't. I remember my son saying that to me once. Mom, he said, if I found out that I had some disease and all I could eat was cardboard to keep me from, you know, for having that disease, I would eat the cardboard and I'd be happy with it. And other people say, don't take my food away. I'd rather be dead, like my brother-in-law did. And he's dead because he wasn't willing to change what he put in his mouth. Our jobs as coaches and practitioners is not just to give them the what to do's, but to help them and coach them to make better decisions, to help them get in touch with what's really most important to them. And don't underestimate that. I've given you resources for that. You can create your own based on my resources or based on your own work. Maybe you are working within a system of getting in touch with those goals and values. It's a super important step, and so I just don't want you to take that lightly as you go through this. And as you go through the Before Be Gone program with me, you'll see that I really emphasize that as a very important part of the process. And one of my patients said to me after she'd lost about 50 pounds and she had had cancer, and she was finding that she had a recurrence of the cancer and decided she better do something about it. And she said to me, she started to run by the motto, don't exchange what you want the most for what you want in the moment. And most people just go for what they want in the moment without regard for what it's causing them and how they're sacrificing what they want the most. So make sure you take that time with your people to really help them get in touch with what they want the most so you can help them to bring them back on course when they start to go astray. Okay. Oops. Okay. And we talked especially last week and the week before about breaking the vicious cycle of high glycemic carbohydrate addiction. This is really important, and I just can't emphasize this enough. It's why I started with don't tell them what to eat, just give them these supplements that help to restore the insulin sensitivity. Yeah, we don't want to just put people on supplements and make them think that's the way they fix their lives. But the point is that if you help them to break the addiction, they're going to make better choices. But the cycle is that they eat these high glycemic carbohydrates, which promote the excess insulin secretion. And then over time, with secreting all that extra insulin, those cells adapt to that high level of insulin by turning it off, by not responding anymore, by putting their hands over their ears and saying, no more, that's enough. And then the high insulin is not allowing the sugar to go into the cells. So what happens is it causes it to get stored as fat and then have a rapid drop in the sugar as like, okay, the sugar's too high, the insulin's too high, and then it gets stored in the fat cells, causing a rapid decline and in some people, hypoglycemia, low sugar, which leads to cortisol or adrenaline to come out and try to bring that sugar back up. It's a survival thing. It's an emergency. We have to bring it up, and that creates the cravings. And so then they go to the high glycemic carbohydrates again, and the whole thing starts all over. So we need to break the cycle, and all the things that we've been learning so far are going to help you break the cycle. And tonight we're going to go a little further, and we're going to talk about the timing and how to put this all together. So remember our key lifestyle areas to address: nutrition. We talked about that already. Stress, exercise, sleep. And we've given you lots of strategies in those areas. And finally, we're going to talk about timing. I cannot underestimate how important this is or overemphasize how important this is. I have had people who have simply done the timing pieces. I had one person who heard me do an overview talk, shared with them the things about timing. She said, I don't have time. I'm moving. I don't have time to do all this fancy food prep and change things much. But she basically started to time her meals, not eat within 3 hours of going to bed, space her meals 4 to 5 hours apart. In 2 months, she dropped 22 pounds. Without changing much else. So the timing is super critical. Not that I'm advocating that. She went on to join Before Be Gone and started following all of it and went on, and now she's down like 75 or 80 pounds and is now off all her medication, hypertension medication, thyroid medication. She never had to go on the blood glucose lowering medication. Her blood sugars range at in around 82 to 85, sometimes 78 to 82. She said, I had a high glycemic morning the day I had my cataract surgery. My blood sugar was up to 86. Whereas she had just been to the doctor before she started all this, and her blood sugar was 119, and they said, you're almost diabetic, lady. You're going to have to go on medication. So don't underestimate the value of timing. You don't have to do these in the order that I've presented them. When I do it as a group, I do it in a set order because that's how you have to do it when you have a group. But if you're working one-on-one with somebody, you're going to do a really good consultation and really get to know them and figure out where the best place to start would be. The best place to start is not necessarily the one that's quote-unquote most important to the outcome. It's the one that they're most likely to follow through on, get some result, and then be really excited about continuing. Okay. So let's talk about meal timing. Why is meal timing important? Well, meal timing is important because it affects the ratios of hormones and the effects of one hormone on the other in terms of keeping the interfering with the mechanisms. And we'll talk about those very specifically. But here are some meal timing rules I'm going to share with you. And then from here, I'm going to go through and share with you why it's important and what the mechanisms are so you understand it and you can explain it in however much detail you need to explain it for your client or your patient, right? Some of them want to know in gruesome detail. Some of them just say, tell me what to do. But you understand it, you're going to be better able to explain it. So let's look at, I hit the button too soon. Sorry about that. So let's look at some of the meal timing guidelines. Number one, no snacking. Why do we have the no snacking? Well, when you eat more frequently, your glucose, your insulin is going to be up all day long. And remember what insulin is. Insulin is a fat storage hormone. It's not a burning hormone. So what does that mean? If a person's snacking all day long, their insulin never goes down to normal. Their growth hormone never gets to peak. And they are basically in fat storage mode all day long. I don't know about you, but I have very few clients who want to be in fat storage mode all day long. And then the only time they have to burn fat would be at night. But then we find that they are eating late at night. They eat right before they go to bed, which causes an insulin spike, which thwarts the growth hormone spike, and we'll show you some charts on that in a little bit. And so they can't have their growth hormone spike, which means they're not going to go into fat burning and repair of lean muscle tissue. One thing that is important, though, as we're looking at spacing the meals out, is that you don't want them getting famished, weak, or jittery in between meals because that will put them into a stress state, cause the secretion of cortisol and adrenaline, which will cause them to actually do counters that will cause their blood sugar to go up because it's an emergency. So no getting famished, but spacing the meals as far apart as possible. And when you see how we present this in the Before Be Gone program, you're going to see a model of how you can present it to your own clients. Okay, and we also have it in your menu plan and recipe guide, your menu planner, and that has a whole section on snacking. We have a snack attack strategy that I gave you, and I gave you that as a separate document in the nutrition module. So when you want to have them avoid eating a high carbohydrate breakfast. If they can eat carbs without it raising their blood sugar, so say they can eat brown rice and quinoa and lentils, and that doesn't raise their blood sugar, great. Don't have them do that in the morning, because when they do it in the morning, it throws off the levels of leptin. And I'll show you a chart in a bit of how that happens. And that when leptin levels get thrown off and it peaks too soon in the day, then they get the cravings at night. So if they are not so sensitive to carbs that they have to avoid them completely, have them do it later in the day. Have them do it for the evening meal and not too close to bedtime. Eating protein within an hour of waking is important for so many people. It helps to promote growth hormone, and it helps to regulate insulin, and also helps with the cortisol levels throughout the day. and then gradually increase the meal spacing. Remember, we're not allowed to let them get famished, weak, or jittery, so if they're used to eating every hour, you don't tell them, okay, now you have to eat every 6 hours. The compliance is going to be low, or if they're one of these people that is very compliant and will listen to everything you say, they are going to get really, really have a hard time between those meals. So you need to just work with it slowly and work with increasing the capacity at each meal, like Beverly was talking about with her client who had a stomach bypass. She can't eat very much at a time. So you might not get that person to go to a six-hour spacing between meals because her stomach physically can't hold enough. But there might be ways to get around that as well, and it's a matter of being creative as you work with people. So let's look at timing and summary of insulin resistance reset protocols. Okay. Come on, computer. Be nice. Okay. So what's the timing all about anyway? Well, it's a matter of getting the hormones in balance, and there are certain activities that you can share with your clients to help do that. So what are the hormones that are particularly sensitive to timing of activities? And I'm not just talking food. I'm talking food, exercise, and sleep. Hormones are leptin, ghrelin, growth hormone, insulin, melatonin, and cortisol. And we'll go through all of those in a little bit more detail so you understand the basic mechanism of how they work. The activities that you can control in terms of timing are sleep and awake. When do you sleep? When do you wake up? Being full and hungry. And we'll talk about one of the advantages of being hungry for a little while in terms of inducing growth hormone. And then exercise and rest. And the balance between all these is going to be what's really important in helping them get their sugars under control. So when you eat is as important as what you eat. Why? Well, there's a control center in the brain called the hypothalamus. You've all heard of that before. And it controls your response to life. It controls your temperature and your sleep patterns and your response to light and darkness and your hunger and your thirst and exercise and stress. There's all kinds of things that are affected by the hypothalamus. And the when you eat affects the way that the hypothalamus controls that. So let's take a look at that. One of the things that happens when you aren't paying attention to the timing and when you are getting these hormones out of balance, and some of them are over-secreting and others are under-secreting, is you develop hormone resistance. And we all know about insulin resistance, right? Because that's what this whole course is all about, is insulin resistance. When there's too much insulin and it causes the receptors to basically get burned out and they no longer hear the signal of insulin and we get blood sugar imbalance. But there's also leptin resistance. And leptin resistance is very common. As we'll see, leptin is a hormone that's secreted by your fat cells, and it says, enough, I've had enough food, let's go into fat burning, we don't need to take in more food, we can just use what we have for the next few hours. Well, people who are overweight say to me, well, why am I overweight then? Because I must have plenty of leptin. It's just secreting all the time because I have a lot of fat cells. Well, leptin resistance. Because you have so much fat in the cells and you've overridden many times. How many of you have never overridden the signal that you're full and you kept eating? We've all done it. And when you do that too much, it causes the hypothalamus, which hears the signal of leptin, to say, oh, you again? Forget it. You don't mean it. Let's just, you know, I'm going to ignore you. You're there all the time. And so it develops the resistance and it doesn't turn off the appetite. But you can even get adrenaline resistance. You know, people who are hooked on their own adrenaline, adrenaline junkies, develop adrenaline resistance. And what that causes is decrease in fat burning. Because when adrenaline gets released, it helps a process called lipolysis or lipolysis. There's different ways to say it. So that's one thing. And then thyroid resistance. We develop thyroid resistance a lot of times as a result of, well, medicating with thyroid. Some people are on really high levels of thyroid for a really long period of time and the cells get resistant. But more important than thyroid itself is cortisol. Cortisol and inflammation, cytokines, they will basically damage the thyroid receptors on your cells and cause your body to become resistant to the signal of thyroid. So inflammation, chronic inflammation, which could be, you know, post-trauma and you ignore it and don't get that under control, eating a diet that's inflammatory, lots of foods that are inflammatory, eating food allergens. It could be a hidden infection somewhere in the body, whether it's in the gut or in a joint or in the sinuses. And it could be also stress, because cortisol affects the thyroid resistance, and so many people are under stress and overproducing cortisol, and that affects it. So all of these resistances all come together to affect your blood sugar. Okay, so let's look at leptin. So leptin peaks in the late afternoon, late evening, and it's at its lowest point when you wake up. So when leptin peaks, if you don't have leptin resistance, then that the appetite's going to be turned off. So your appetite will be fine between dinner and bedtime because, right, you're not supposed to eat then. But if you don't, if you either have leptin resistance or you've done something to cause that peak earlier in the day, then what happens is you're craving food right after dinner. You have a full dinner, and even though stomach is full, you're still going, I want food, especially sweets. So that happens when leptin gets out of rhythm, and we're going to teach you how to understand leptin so you can help your clients to do that. And then high glycemic carbohydrates early in the day, I mentioned this earlier, they cause leptin to peak earlier. So it may peak earlier, like say before dinner, and then by the time after dinner comes, the levels are going down and the appetite kicks in and the craving for food kicks in. And then if you entertain that appetite and you actually eat right before bed, we'll see on the next few slides that that affects growth hormone. And then you don't have the nice growth hormone surge that happens right after you fall asleep. And that affects fat burning as well. So all of these things affect fat burning, and they affect the levels of insulin and insulin resistance in the cells. So five rules that you can teach your clients, and I didn't come up with these. They are well documented. There's a really good book called Mastering Leptin. It's 400 and something pages long, and it's got hundreds of references on all the stuff that they talk about. And basic rules are, don't ever eat after dinner. Make your dinner is the last food that you eat. Make it, there be at least 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and at least 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. That'll help your leptin levels. Eat three meals a day, not four, not five, not six. Eat three meals a day. No snacking in between. Their recommendation is 4 to 6 hours between meals. More than 6 hours, maybe not as good, because with more than 6 hours, you might get into the starvation mode. May not happen right away, but chronically having more than 6 hours between meals could cause a problem where you go into starvation mode. So, for example, we'll talk about something called intermittent fasting, where one day a week you're going to go a really long time between your meals. And that's really good as long as it's intermittent. That's why it's called intermittent fasting. But fasting on a regular basis down-regulates your metabolism. Why? Because it decreases the level of leptin because your body's going, ooh, starving, starving, eat, eat, and it creates a problem. So a lot of longer fasts, you have to be really careful coming off a longer fast. And it can be challenging coming off a longer fast because it's just like your body wants food. But if you do intermittent fasting where 1 day a week or 2 days a week, not two consecutive days, you fast, you have your clients fast, it's going to affect their insulin levels, it's going to affect insulin sensitivity, and their leptin resistance is going to go way down. And I've had people do this, and it's had phenomenal results. And some people 1 day a week, some two, and it depends on where they are in their cycle, right? Because if they're in the cycle where they still have a tremendous amount of weight to lose, it's advantageous to do it 2 days a week. But if they're closer to their ideal weight and they're just trying to maintain it, then maybe just 1 day a week because it can promote some rapid weight loss. We mentioned this earlier, but this is one of the leptin, mastering leptin rules, is eat a high-protein breakfast. ideally eat it within an hour to an hour and a half of getting up in the morning, because that sets everything for the day. If you start the day with carbs, you're going to cause that leptin peak we talked about. If you start it with protein, it helps everything to stay stable. And then reduce overall the amount of carbs eaten. And on the insulin resistance protocols that we've been talking about, that's what we're doing, at least for those 30 days. And then you're monitoring to find out what that person tolerates. I'm not an advocate of everybody needs to be on a low-carbohydrate diet. I personally am on a low-carbohydrate diet because that's what my body needs. And I have a bunch of people who are, and I have other people who can make a smoothie with 8 bananas and lots of greens, and their blood sugar goes up to 96. Do they have to be on a low-carb diet? Maybe not, right, unless that carb is causing them to have some kind of yeast overgrowth. But that's another story. So that's Mastering Leptin, great book. So let's look at the chart, normal leptin function, right? We showed you this last week. I'll just review it really quickly, or last call, the part three presentation. Leptin, when leptin's perceived properly, you're not going to be hungry after dinner because it's going to, it goes up, it peaks at around 2 hours after sleep, midnight, right, which is really a great time for it to peak, and then it starts to come down, and then fat burning begins in the middle of the night. If it peaks earlier and you're still eating when it's peaking, you're going to miss that fat burning, because fat burning can happen in the presence of insulin. Just, you know, keep this in your mind and really share this with your patient. You cannot burn fat when you have levels, high levels above baseline of insulin. It's impossible. It is impossible. So if you have somebody who needs to burn fat, they cannot do it while insulin is in their system. So you need to have this nice rhythm of leptin and insulin happening. So this is what normally happens, and this is what happens when they're off. Their level peaks sooner, and then it's starting to go down after midnight. And then it's not the level of fat burning is going to be much lower, because it's that, you know, that whole thing that happens at around 4 a.m. where it starts, but it really doesn't happen that much because it peaked too soon and it's on the downhill spiral. Okay? So really important to understand this. And then intimately connected with the leptin cycle is the growth hormone cycle. And the growth hormone peaks after intense exercise bursts and stays elevated for 90 minutes. So if you do 30 minutes of cardio, moderate cardio, your growth hormone will stay elevated for 90 minutes. Like it peaks right after and then it starts to go down, but it takes 90 minutes. It stays elevated. If you do 30 seconds of intense burst activity, like all out up to the max, you get that same elevation in growth hormone. And actually some of the studies show that it goes a little higher. And then it comes down and still takes 90 minutes. So if you get people doing 30-second bursts multiple times throughout the day, it's going to put them in fat burning throughout the day, as long as they're not eating within an hour and a half, that hour and a half of either side. So when you really sit down with it, you can time your eating and your exercise bursts such that you maximize the amount of time in fat burning. Now, if you've got somebody you're working with who is skinny as a rail and doesn't want to lose weight, then you can also use this to help them to maintain their weight and gain, actually. It peaks at midnight, assuming you're going to bed at 11 o'clock. It actually peaks about an hour after you go to bed, but studies that I've looked at have shown that if you go to bed past midnight, much past midnight, you don't get as high a peak in the growth hormone. And the growth hormone peaks once every sleep cycle. And we learned last week that we have probably 4 to 5 sleep cycles, depending on the length of them throughout the night. And once in each of those sleep cycles, it peaks. But the biggest one by far is in that first one. So if you have somebody that eats a snack right before they go to bed, they have insulin in their system. Growth hormone doesn't like insulin. They are like the cousins that are at war with each other. They won't play in the same pen. So once the insulin is up, the growth hormone drops down. Same thing with after exercise. If you do this great exercise and then you go get one of those lovely Gatorades and eat that, or gel packs or whatever else they're pushing for you to have energy, you completely stop fat burning and you go into fat storage mode. So that's not good. And the other thing Yeah, so it's antagonized by insulin. So you really want to be careful about that timing. It's super, super important. So here's a little picture of the effect of exercise on growth hormone. So the upper curve is a 30-second all-out burst, like a sprint, or if you're on an exercise bike, just pushing it to the max and shooting it up, or getting it on a Hang on one second, I had something in my way. You get on like one of the Stairmasters or something at the gym and you just push it all out for 30 seconds and then you go back to the nice, easy pace. There's a number of ways that you can teach people to do burst training, and we talked about those in the module that we did on fitness. But it basically, the more they do it, the more they're going to shoot their growth hormone levels up. But there was an interesting thing that showed that when you did a second sprint, 60 minutes after, it didn't do anything to the growth hormone. But if you waited till after it came back down and you waited a couple of hours or an hour and a half and then did another sprint, then it brought the growth hormone up to the same and sometimes even higher levels. And we have a reference list in the program that you can look at if you want to really look at these in more detail. So we've talked about the effect of leptin and growth hormone on our whole insulin resistance and belly fat burning and all that, but cortisol is important as well. Cortisol generally peaks at 8 in the morning. So if you do one of those adrenal stress saliva tests, you'll see that the highest level of cortisol is generally in the morning, is ideally in the morning, although some people have really low levels in the morning and they're people who are in adrenal burnout. It's lowest at midnight. And again, you're going to see if you do these tests on people that those people who have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, you're going to see peaks in the cortisol starts to go up, which helps them, makes them not sleep. It doesn't help them not sleep. It's kind of not something they want help with. And then there's a sharp decline between 8 a.m. and noon, and then a gradual decline until evening. And so the reason for that is the cortisol is there to get us awake, to get all the systems go. And so it's sharp in the morning, and then it settles down, and then it peaks during the day under stressful circumstances. So if you're sitting at your desk stewing at your boss, or you've got a deadline and you can't meet it, or there's a lot of things that cause temporary spikes in cortisol, and it comes back down again. So that's the ideal with cortisol. And let's look at how cortisol. Now, the thing about cortisol is cortisol. Oops, something with this computer in the. Sorry about that. There we go. It's a real sensitive little keypad. The cortisol is in a rhythm, and this just is showing you graphically what that rhythm looks like. High in the morning, it goes back down, it comes back up again. Usually starts to rise again at about 4 o'clock. So what happens? And the reason that cortisol is so important with the blood sugar issues, we talked about this last week in our stress piece, was that your cortisol, when it elevates, its job is to raise your blood sugar. Because you're running away from a hungry tiger. You need sugar in your blood to fuel your muscles, to get your heart pumping fast. So it's natural for that cortisol to go up when you're under stress. So if you're getting to be under stress a lot during the day, you're going to be having spikes in your insulin, right? You're going to have blood sugar go up, and then you're going to have insulin spikes, and that's going to affect the whole fat burning, fat storage. And the cool part, which I'll just reiterate from last week's presentation, is that when cortisol goes for fuel to burn and turn into sugar, it generally doesn't go for fat storage, unfortunately. It goes for muscle. It goes for gluconeogenesis, breakdown protein stores, because it's quick and easy for it to do. So basically, you can be, if you're not running away from a tiger, you're sitting at your desk stewing, you're sitting there and your blood sugar goes up because you broke down your thighs, and then insulin goes too high and eventually gets stored back around your waist. So if you want to turn, people love hearing this. If you want to turn your thighs into belly fat, get stressed out all day. So one of the things you can do to help dissipate that stress, and we talked about this a little bit last week, was to exercise. So teach them that if they're feeling really stressed out, to run up and down the stairs or do something to actually burn that sugar, because otherwise it's going to sit there and it's going to go on your belly. So people can be just sitting there at their desk adding to their belly fat. Happens all the time. Okay. So let's look at protein timing in insulin. Insulin increases protein synthesis. It also increases fat synthesis. So that's what its job is. It's an anabolic hormone. It's an anabolic meaning it stores. It makes things to store. So if the protein's available in the bloodstream and the blood sugar is normal, insulin almost completely stops the process of breaking down muscles for your protein needs. So you get up in the morning and you feed yourself with protein, then your body's not going to try to burn fat, burn muscle to make sugar. It's got the protein in the bloodstream and it can convert that to sugar. So especially if you're getting stressed, probably if you have a specific time of day that you're the most stressed, have a protein shake. You know, right before you know you're having a meeting with your boss, have a protein shake so that when the cortisol goes to find you more fuel, it's not going to have to go very far and break your muscles down. So if the protein's not available and the glucose is normal, muscle breakdown is stopped partially. But if the blood sugar is high, insulin then stimulates muscle breakdown throughout your body. So let me say that again. If your blood sugar is high, the high level of insulin will stimulate the muscle breakdown throughout your body, okay? So that's the takeaway. Every time you stimulate insulin production by eating carbohydrates, you need to eat some complete protein with it, or instead of rebuilding your muscles and tissues, your body will continue to dissemble itself to get that protein. So this is all science. This is not anything that I made up. This is not anything from, you know, kind of theory or conjecture. This is all in the science. So leptin, when you have a high glycemic diet and the insulin surges, too much fat from overeating causes excess leptin. We talked about that. The pancreas and the hypothalamus both develop leptin resistance by shutting down the receptors when it's too high. So it's always reading your gas tank as empty, even when it's full. So if your gas tank always read as empty when you're on the road, you're going to spend a lot of time looking for a gas station to refuel. Same in your body. Increases appetite, decreases metabolism, because we're saying conserve. So the pancreas reduces its insulin in response to rising leptin. So basically, you eat the meal and the insulin goes up, you've got sugar in your system, the leptin levels are stimulated because you're storing it, and then you basically turn off that. And if the pancreas has become leptin resistant, then it just continues to secrete insulin when normally it would stop doing that. So when you go back to those charts we looked at, that's why it's really important to maintain those rules about leptin so you don't get into trouble that way. So the timing for protein for optimal, protein within an hour of getting up. There are some gurus who say 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of rising. Actually, that was not necessarily a health guru. That was in the 4-minute body. Is it the 4-minute workout, the 4-minute body by the guy that wrote the four-hour work week, the 4-hour body, something like that. He did this experiment, and he discovered that people who had 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of rising tended to burn fat better. It's an experiment from one guy with a group of people, but it's something to keep in mind if you're working with somebody who's having some difficulties to say, well, give this a try for just about a week, just do 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of rising. That means that they're going to have to do some pretty intense stuff like protein powders and like I've figured out a green smoothie that had, you know, like a pound of kale and a couple of scoops of protein powder, and that had 30 grams of protein. And this is going to keep your leptin, insulin, and cortisol all balanced and in control. So here's a study. A protein-rich breakfast reduced food cravings. It was from the University of Missouri. A researcher found that eating a healthy breakfast, especially one high in protein, increases satiety and reduces hunger throughout the day. In addition, using functional magnetic resonance imaging, the researchers found that eating a protein-rich breakfast reduces the brain's signals controlling food motivation and reward-driven eating behavior. So there's evidence here. This is just one of many studies that I found, and I've got a really long list of the references in a document we'll put up on your page in the timing resources. So since your cortisol peaks at 8 a.m., and its role is to create new glucose from storage to get you going for the day. If you eat protein, it's going to be used as fuel rather than breaking down your muscle, because that's what cortisol's job is. When cortisol's high like that, it's looking for protein to break down into glucose. And if you've eaten the protein, then it doesn't use the muscles. It uses the protein in the situation. And that's why eating in the morning, within an hour of getting up, when that cortisol level is its highest, tends to be really effective. Now, there are some people, and a lot of intermittent fasting research shows that some people do really well with skipping breakfast and just having one meal and doing that one day a week. But when you do it on a regular basis, it can be problematic. But again, you've got to work with your person where they're at. So here's a couple more studies you can look up. Salk Institute found that the daily waxing and waning of thousands of genes in the liver is mostly controlled by food intake and not the circadian snack, the circadian clock. So it's not set in time when this happens. It's more related to when you're eating and when you're fasting. So you're either in a fasted state or a fed state. And then there's a researcher called Panda. He did a lot of insulin resistance type studies, found out that the activity of your fat-burning genes is highest when you haven't eaten for a while. And that's why we like to have that 4 to 6 hours between meals. And that's going to stimulate the fat-burning genes as well as the other hormonal things that we talked about. So, again, another study. If feeding time determines the activity of a large number of genes completely independent of the circadian clock, when you eat and fast every day, that will have a huge impact on your metabolism. So we want to be in a fasted state, fed state, fasted state, fed state. So these people who are eating because they've been told it's important to do every 2 hours, really do the research and feel, make your own decision about what you feel is right. But the research is really strongly pointing to that is a really poor idea, and I've given you a research paper I wrote. It's about 18 pages, including references, to help you make that decision. And again, you have to go by each individual person. Like Beverly's person who has the stomach bypass, it's going to be different, and it's going to be, you may have to work with people slowly and gradually to move them to the meal spacing. But overall, the meal spacing is the best thing. Meal frequency and weight loss. I like to give you studies so that you can look them up yourself, so I've given you a bunch of studies in here. Increased meal frequency does not promote greater weight loss in subjects who were prescribed an 8-week equal caloric energy restricted diet. You'll hear this all the time, right? Eat 6 small meals a day. A lot of really popular people that are writing about blood sugar, you know, they're not looking at the research, I don't think. They're not looking at the science. They're looking at popular stuff. They want you not to get too hungry between meals so you don't trigger cortisol, but there are ways to plan your meals so that you're filled and satiated so you don't trigger that. So let's look at a couple more hormones, and then we'll move on to the summaries. And we won't go through these in excruciating detail because you've got them in documents that will be uploaded to the site later in the week. So ghrelin, what's ghrelin? Ghrelin is a hormone secreted by your belly, your stomach. The cells in your stomach secrete ghrelin to say, ooh, I'm empty, I'm hungry. And it sends a signal to the brain and says, I'm hungry. When you eat, you suppress ghrelin. When you're hungry, you secrete ghrelin. Very, very simple. Stimulates your appetite. But here's the good part. Most people don't like to be hungry. They think that as soon as they're hungry, they have to eat something. It's like, you know, do you ever have an itch in public and it was in a place you just can't scratch in public? You live with it. You just live with it. You know, you can't satisfy all your desires or urges at the time you have them. Same thing with hunger. So when you're hungry, and you explain this to your patients, especially those that need to lose weight, is that here's the good thing that happens. When you get hungry, you increase the secretion of growth hormone. Growth hormone increases your muscles and decreases your fat. So wouldn't you like that? Doesn't mean to stay in that state for hours, because then you can end up with, you know, way too low blood sugar and it's not going to work real well. But if you just do it for a short period of time, say a half an hour, you say, okay, I'm going to get hungry and I'm going to stay hungry for a half an hour before I eat again. Your body gets trained. And so you can teach this to your clients and patients. It's really important because it is a potent stimulator of growth hormone. And you know, we want more and more growth hormone. People are paying a lot of money to get shot up with growth hormone because it's effective. It's an effective stimulator. Why get shot up with it? Why pay a fortune and have the risks? I did a radio show on that once. You know, it's like, why go through that? Just do it naturally. And this is one of the ways. Just love your hunger. Appreciate the hunger. Make friends with hunger. So let's just review the rules. The rules for managing leptin and insulin: never eat after dinner. Why? Because you have that insulin surge. It affects your growth hormone. It affects your leptin. Don't eat after. Eat only 3 meals a day. When you eat in between, you're in a constant state of fat storage. Allow 5 to 6 hours between meals. I've been saying 4 to 6 just because 4 is more reasonable for people, but really 5 to 6 is the optimal. Okay. Don't eat large meals and eat slowly. And people say to me, well, okay, you want me to go four to six hours between meals, but I'm not supposed to eat large meals? No, you eat to capacity. You don't want to overdo it because overdoing it is problematic. And eating slowly helps you to get the signal that you're full before you're overfull. Right? And the overfull feeling just affects the whole system. So you really want to do it slowly and allow the time in between. And the breakfast-containing protein, I can't emphasize that enough, and reduce the amount of starchy carbohydrates. And that's not a timing rule per se, but I threw it in there just because it's so important. So all these others are timing rules, right? This is all about timing. It's not just what to do, it's when to do it. Oops. Okay, so let's review. We've said these, I'm going to say these enough times that you're going to have them down. Please get them to quit eating 3 hours before bedtime. If you're still eating right up to bedtime, start with doing it yourself. And the more you do it yourself, the better you feel. The other thing I just wanted to mention, just related to leptin, and it's not really related to timing, but it is in a way, you want to get a full 8 hours of sleep if you can. What I discover is that if I don't get enough sleep, then especially if I go to bed really late, I'm missing that growth hormone surge, but I'm also affecting that surge of leptin, and it doesn't turn off my appetite. So the next day after I don't eat and get enough sleep, I am starving. And then on days when I get plenty of sleep, I can go hours without eating. So this concept of burst and burn before bed, about 2 hours after your last meal and about at least an hour before bed. If you do a 2-minute high-intensity burst, it tends to lower the fasting glucose in the morning. And I've seen it over and over. People on the Before Be Gone program, they'd be like, I'm doing all these things and my fasting sugar's still low. I say, try this one. Are you doing this one? No. They do it and boom, blood sugar in the morning's 86. So it happens a lot. Now, if it's somebody that's waking up at 3 in the morning because they were molested as a child at 3 in the morning, that's not necessarily going to help. You're going to have to be working on more of the emotional stuff. But it can help dramatically for people where that's an issue. Extending the time between meals to 5 hours is ideal, 5-6. Consume protein within an hour of waking. We've said it before. Avoid high-carbohydrate breakfasts. You're probably going to hear me in your sleep tonight from saying that. Practice breathing and appreciation before each meal. Why? Because that gets you out of your sympathetic mode and into the parasympathetic. That gets you out of the cortisol load mode, which shuts down digestion, and into more of the acetylcholine and other of those nice parasympathetic hormones, which help with memory and satiation and all that, and calmness. And then bed no later than 11 p.m. is the ideal. Midnight at the outset, but the earlier the better, right? So if you've got somebody who's used to going to bed at 2, you're not going to say, okay, starting tomorrow, your bedtime's 11. They're not going to buy it. You're going to have to move it back gradually. And I find 15-minute increments, while it's slow, it works well for people. And then plan fitness bursts 2 hours after each meal. So that'll give you time to have the insulin levels dropping back down. It'll burn whatever sugar's left in your system. It'll cause a growth hormone spike, stimulate fat burning between meals, and it's going to regulate everything really, really well. So on the page on your site, we have some summary documents, and those will be loaded up later in the week. And so let me give you an overview of the 30-day plan you're going to be putting people on. Again, it might be longer for some people. It might be shorter for others. But this is the overview, and then we'll just go through the summaries of each in each area. Greens, chia seeds, or other omega-3 foods, green powder optionally in the morning within an hour of getting up. I find that that's a really nice balance. You've got the omega-3s, you've got the protein, and you've got all the phytonutrients in the greens and all the minerals that help with keeping your blood sugars balanced. Add walking or low-intensity aerobics, even just getting them to do 20 minutes to a half an hour of walking, or 10-minute bursts of walking were found to be just as effective. So if you say to people, hey, I don't have time for that, hey, well, can you find 5 minutes, 10 minutes? That can be helpful. The burst training, we talked about that in the fitness part, and we gave you lots of videos and things that you can do. Experiment with a cleansing day or day each week. That's for those especially who need to lose a little bit of weight. The ones that are thin may not want to do this, although it can be highly beneficial even for thin people. And that's where it's either all day of just juicing or smoothies. But what's better than all day is to do it where it's a 24-hour period that starts somewhere in the day. So it's not like you wake up in the morning and you don't eat or you do just juicing. You have a normal breakfast, and then you skip lunch and dinner, or you just juice or, you know, blend or something like that, and then you have a normal breakfast the next day. So it doesn't feel like such a burden. You're really only missing two main meals, and it can either be where you do cleansing foods like juices and broths and smoothies, or it could be where you fast with water, and that's called intermittent fasting. And we've got a document that describes in great detail how to do that. But that really helps people when they do that once a week. That really helps to reset things and keep them on track. The stress management, which we talked about in our last session, whatever they can do. You may be a stress management specialty. Maybe you have a specific type of meditation that you teach. I give you an example of what I teach, but you can use whatever it is that works for you and for your clients, and always ask them what they're doing and see if that's sufficient or you need to just get them to do more of it. The bedtime by 11 p.m. and then schedule 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night while they're in this 30-day phase can be dramatic, really dramatic. So this is what you want them to do for 30 days. You may have a period of 30 days leading up to this where you're gradually introducing these concepts, and then you go, okay, here's what we want to do, and we're going to do this for 30 days. But you're also going to eat only the foods that keep the blood sugar under 110 at all times. And with this, the recommendations that I've given you, that will happen. So it's a 30-day strict low-glycemic diet. No sugar, of course, of any kind. And that means stevia is okay. That means agave and maple syrup and all that. No grains, unless it's really clear that they tolerate it, especially in your thinner patients. They may say, well, quinoa is fine. It doesn't raise my blood sugar. It gives me that extra bulk and keeps me full. Then that's fine. But for your overweight people or your diabetic or pre-diabetic people, that's going to be problematic if it raises their blood sugar. So 30 days of no grains can be really dramatic. If they're not willing to go 30 days with no grains at all and they're doing quinoa, things like that, just make sure they're not doing any flours like pastas and breads. That's can be problematic. Potatoes tend to spike blood sugars high, so we avoid those. We avoid bananas and other high glycemic fruits. So mangoes, papaya, pineapple can be on that list. And you remember from part one, we went through the whole process of getting them to do testing. So they're going to know what these foods are. If you've got somebody who doesn't want to do the pricking of their finger, then you give them the most strict thing to follow. And it's a 30-day metabolic reset. And no dried fruit and no fruit juice, because those are treated by the body just like sugar. If they tolerate low glycemic fruits, small quantities, the berries are usually good. For some people, the green apples. For some people, not all, the grapefruits. I've had a lot of my patients who just can't tolerate grapefruit. It shoots their sugar up to 185. So you avoid it. So any other foods that you need to have them avoid would be heated oils and trans fats. because those are inflammatory and those are going to damage the insulin receptors. And remember, we're trying to heal them. The reason for the strict low glycemic diet is to give the cells a break from insulin. They've put up their hands and said, I'm resistant now because they've had so much insulin for so long. And you're just trying to give them a break. So you don't want to have any of these insulin surges. You want to eliminate their top allergens and any known allergens. You'd be surprised at how many people will come to you and say, oh, I'm allergic to watermelon. Whenever I eat it, I break out in hives. And you go, oh, well, how often do you eat it? Oh, not that often, maybe once a week. It's like, really? You think that's okay? No, it's not. When you know that something they're allergic to, you need to stop it because it's causing inflammation. And if it's causing external inflammation like hives, it's for sure causing some inflammation internally with all those histamines floating in the system. And then anything that raises their blood sugar above 110, even if it's an avocado and that raises their blood sugar above 110, or it's lettuce. Now, here's the caveat with this, and here's the exception to this. You have somebody who's a diabetic whose fasting blood sugar is 120. You're not going to get them down to 110 right away. So you've got to work within the range. So you have them chart and you see what their ranges are and you have them avoid foods that raise their blood sugar more than 20 to 25 points. So if their level, their fasting blood sugar is 120, you're going to say, okay, you're not allowed to eat any foods that raise your blood sugar above 140 to 145. And that way they're going to be getting it, they're going to be affecting a change overall. Because, of course, you can't get somebody who starts at 130 to be below 110 of all times. That would be their dream. Okay, but we're talking about people who are marginally insulin resistant or are truly insulin resistant but haven't jumped over into the diabetic range. If they're into the diabetic range, you need to be a little bit different criteria here. Here are the foods as a review, the top six allergens. I always get them off of the top six allergens for 30 days if I can get them to do it. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. Some people have problems with others, the runners-up, the others that are high and popular on the allergy list, shellfish, tree nuts, strawberries, citrus, oats, and yeast. But with tree nuts, I want to say, people do this great. Doctors don't really understand a lot about the allergies that cashews are not in the same family as macadamia nuts. So if somebody's allergic to macadamia nuts, it doesn't mean they have to avoid cashews. If they're allergic to almonds, it doesn't mean they have to avoid pine nuts. They're different families. So somebody just says across the board they're allergic to tree nuts, I'm highly suspicious. It's rare. Okay? And I've had somebody who started the Before Be Gone program exceptionally allergic to lemon. So she was like, all your drinks have lemon in them. What am I going to do? And we said, okay, we'll try the apple cider vinegar for that sour instead of the lemon. And she did that, and she did the whole program, and she lost weight, and she got her sugars under control, and voila, now she can eat citrus. She has no problem eating citrus. So she cleaned things up, and now so this is not permanent. So I'm going to talk to you in about a minute now. We're going to move into what's the maintenance phase. So once they've done this for 30 days, do you say, okay, 30 days is over, go at it and do whatever you want? No, you don't want them to backtrack. So in order for them to be ready for the maintenance phase, they need to have had at least 3 weeks of stable glucose, under 110, and rarely, if ever, below fasting level within two levels, meaning they're not going into reactive hypoglycemia. Now, this does apply for your diabetics, because obviously if somebody's been diabetic, they're not going to reverse it in 30 days. I've seen major shifts in 30 days. They may not shift it completely, although I could tell you a couple of stories of people who did. I had one guy whose fasting was 220. Within 2 weeks of us working together, his fasting was like 90. And he had even had dips down into the 70s. So it can happen quickly, but with the diabetics, you may have to have them on this program longer. But if once they get to the point where there's 3 weeks straight of stable glucose, where they're not going above 110 and rarely, if ever, below fasting, and they're consistently taking their basic supplements, like we talked about chromium and magnesium and DHA, possibly some of the other things, the other foods and herbs like berberine and olive leaf and lipoic acid and some of the others, then they have to be consistent. They're fairly consistent. It means they're not 100% necessarily, but they're fairly consistent on the exercise, stress, and sleep, and they're noticing improvements. Like I had one person came you know, after a month I saw her and it was like, whoa, what have you been doing? And she looked at me, she goes, I'm doing your program. This is somebody who was on my group program and she had signed up online and she came to a couple of events and I had seen her a month before and I just, my head dropped because it was like, whoa. Yeah, she dropped like 23 pounds and 9 inches in a month. It was crazy, but it happens. So they're fairly consistent and they're noticing improvements. It's either their weight is improved, their brain fog's improved, their energy's improved. Overall, they're feeling better. Their glucose numbers are improved. It's not going to necessarily be all of them. So then you're ready to help them to move back in. But I will caution you, there's certain foods that it's best for them to continue to avoid for life. And those, what are those? Sugar and all its relatives. With an occasional hint of some unrefined sweetener in an otherwise healthy food. Like, so say they're having some, you know, tart that grandma made. Grandma probably wouldn't make it. It's probably one of their friends who are into health food made that has a pinch of honey in it. And it's otherwise it's got, or it's a smoothie that has a pinch of honey and it's got all kinds of greens. But overall, they should be avoiding sugar, right? Test and don't make it a habit. So if you are going to try something that has a little honey in it, test the blood sugars. And if you get away with it, yeah, but don't make it a habit because you're going to go back into the problem. Pasteurized fruit juice. Nobody should eat pasteurized fruit juice. Even unpasteurized, like fresh squeezed fruit juice, I don't think it should be eaten alone, drunk alone. I think it should be drunk as part of, say, a green juice, like 20% or less of a green juice, if they tolerate it. Okay, flour, even the whole grain flour, because the body handles it like sugar and it chews those sugars up. There may be some exceptions, but also baked flour products contain acrylamide, and that's a known carcinogen, and it causes inflammation, right? We're trying to get their inflammation down. Heated polyunsaturated oils and trans fats, nobody should eat those. They're just bad foods, right? Nobody should eat those. Nobody disagrees about that either, right? Shortening, mayonnaise, margarine, the chips that say partially hydrogenated soybean oil. Gluten. I think most people who have come to the stage where they're having the problems that you're dealing with probably should avoid it unless you've tested them and found themselves to be unreactive. So you've gotten a stool test or you've gotten one of those panels from Cerex Labs that does 20 different antigens and they're non-reactive and they're asymptomatic. And I put the links to the labs that you can get those tested at in Terra Lab or Cerex Labs. All their known allergens, unless they've discovered they could put it back in because they've healed their leaky gut, just stay away from them. And then if they're going to eat animal products, eat real animal products, whole, pastured, organically raised. Don't eat the luncheon meats and the stuff processed with all kinds of stuff. So these are the things I don't think people should eat at all. Probably nobody should eat, but especially somebody who's coming off of a gluten insulin resistance. So let's talk about the stuff they can add back. We want to get them on the upswing. So when you're reintroducing foods, you'll start with the lowest sugar to highest. What you're going to have on your page is a really cool chart I put together that says a really good recommendation about how to introduce and how to teach them to introduce back. Small amounts of sugar, of fruits can be used in smoothies or with greens on top of salads to start. So they start with the fruit in a way that's less likely to raise their sugars, and they work up towards increasing it to find their tolerance level. So, for example, if I sit down and eat, I took a mango and I cut it in half and I took half the mango and I cut it into small pieces and I ate it on a bed of lettuce. And my sugar was fine. It didn't raise my sugar above like 105. So then I got greedy another time and I put the whole mango on a smaller bed of lettuce and my sugar went up too high. I tried the half a mango by itself and it went up way too high. So I wasn't ready. I wasn't taking the supplements either, so that's another story, but I wasn't ready to add it, so I took it back out. Find a way that they can do it. One way I find to still have the pleasant taste of the fruit without it being blended up and tasting like something else was I would have two or three pieces of that crispy romaine lettuce and then have some of the fruit and then some crispy romaine lettuce and then some of the fruit. So as long as they're doing it with something that's green and helps to absorb it better and slow it down, they usually can get away with it. But again, to tolerance, you guide them through this. This is a process and you're there as their coach. Yeah, you want to go slowly. Tell them not to go and, you know, eat a whole banana if they want to test banana. Try it with a small piece of banana with some lettuce, and then the next time they could have more. And they're going to find their tolerance and what they can do. And I'm fine with them having as much fruit as they can get away with to comfortably keep their system functioning and purring. So how do you know, do they have to take these supplements for life? Maybe. Some of them do. Do they have to take them for a prolonged period? Maybe some of them do. So here's how you know if you could start to decrease the doses of those supplements. If they're maintaining their blood glucose under 100 most of the time and rarely over 110, if their fasting blood sugar is consistently in the 80s or 70s, if they don't have dips in their fasting glucose levels 3 to 5 hours after their meal, and if their symptoms are improving, and they say, you know, I'm really tired of taking these 4 chromium pills every day. Can I reduce it? Yeah. So what do? Do you say, stop it and let's see what happens? No, you don't, because that's what patients want to do. They just want to stop it. I see people all the time that have been on these great protocols, and then they come see me like 3 months after they stopped it, and they're feeling like crap again. No, don't let them do that. So then the typical supplements that we had them on to start was chromium, polynicotinate, 400 micrograms twice a day. So if they're on that, or 200 micrograms 4 times a day, you just have them go to 3 times a day. So you have them go to 600. And they do that for a few days and monitor and see how are they feeling. Are they gaining weight? Are they having more brain fog? Is their blood sugar going up? How's their fasting blood sugar? How is it after meals? If it's fine, then you can go and reduce their magnesium a little bit. You can have them reduce their DHA a little bit. And it's a reminder here, the vanadyl sulfate, if you do put them on that, make sure you just do it 50 milligrams twice a day for 4 weeks, because beyond that, you can get into problems with kidney. It's an overload. The DHA, you know, they may need that permanently if they're not consistently eating foods that, like algae and fish, that contain that. So these are the supplements, and you're just going to gradually decrease their dosage. So draw one capsule or one drop dose every 3 to 4 days. Carefully monitor their fasting sugar and their post-meal glucose, you know, the way we always do it, 15, 30, 45, 60, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours at least when you're weaning off again is important to go back there, right? They may have gone to the point where they just tested at 45 minutes, but now you want to go back and just like kind of see what's happening. Weigh them. Have them weigh themselves to observe for an increase in weight, monitor energy level, mental alertness, and any symptoms that resolved during 30-day metabolic reset. If they're starting to come back when you start to wean off the supplements, you know that that wasn't a good idea to go back. Okay? And if you do them one at a time and you do them a small amount at a time, they're not going to get into such a downward spiral that they start to reverse. Same thing with the allergens. Here's the list again. And you reintroduce them one at a time. I highly recommend that they be off of gluten for at least 6 months, and under the circumstances I said before, that they've tested and they know they're not genetically prone and they know they don't have the antibodies and they're feeling great, then they can introduce it gradually. Dairy, same way. Corn, you know, the other ones are not as problematic. Peanuts, I don't recommend they do back at all, unless it's on an occasional, like occasionally there'll be a peanut or something in a salad that I'll eat. I don't bother to be as picky about that as I am with gluten, but peanuts are inflammatory, and we know inflammation is a problem here. Okay, so we have a whole process for reintroducing the allergens, and I'm giving you that document on your page. And basically, summary, you make 3 columns. They have a safe column, a suspicious column, and a problematic column. And as they test foods that they've removed, they put them in either safe. And in order to get in the safe, they have to have eaten it for 3 days straight and not had any symptoms. Okay, introduced it, eaten it for 3 days straight. Suspicious is they've introduced it, and somewhere in that 3 days that they're introducing it, they get a headache or something happens, but it didn't really seem really clear. It could have been something else. Then it's a suspicious food. They're going to go back again. And problematic is they were feeling great and they started to eat eggs and they got a headache and their intestines blew up and they felt awful within a short period of time. It's a problem. Stick it in the list and avoid it. And you might come back and retest it later. You may have to take them through a leaky gut repair protocol. So that's the reintroduction, and that is something that is as important as it is taking them off of things and putting them on a metabolic reset. It's just as important to be really careful about the reintroduction phase. This is not an overnight process. They may get results overnight, but for them to maintain long-lasting, lifelong results, you're going to be with them for a while. You're going to be in their life. What we do is Before Be Gone, when we take groups through, the program itself goes for about, 10 weeks or so, and then we give them access to our Vital community for 2 months, and then we continue to give them access so they can come on and ask questions, so they have access on an ongoing basis. Those people who are in my private programs that I coach with, we're working on this for months. We're just like really going carefully, and sometimes they'll have setbacks, and they come to you and say, look, I'm falling backwards. You're there to help them, and because you understand it. It's really great when you understand how this works. So highlights of the fitness, you can read these. I know we've been talking for way too long at this point. So you can go through the fitness guidelines, the highlights. You can go through the diet and nutrition guidelines. You can go through the attitude and stress highlights, the sleep highlights, and then the timing highlights. These will all be in documents on your page, so you can review them. They'll be on the copies of these slides that will be on your page, so you'll have access to all this information to review. The recording of this call will be available instantly after it's over. As soon as I hit the end of the session, you'll have access to this, so you can watch the recording, you can listen to it, you can write on the slides. We'll make sure we get you the slides. I'll load them up tomorrow. I didn't have time to get them loaded up on the InstantTel seminar, but we'll get them loaded up, and by the end of the week, we'll have everything loaded up on the site. So I want to open it up for any questions that you guys might have. I know it's late. It'll take like 2 or 3 questions, and then we'll call it a night. And then I'm curious to see what people say about the call next week. We can always just do a Q&A next week if some people are really, really want to do it and then wait. So it's okay. Victoria says, is coconut juice okay during the 30-day low glycemic? I'm really glad you asked that. And my answer is for some people, yes. For some people, no. I tried coconut when I was doing mine, and it shot my sugar up. I even tried it blended with the coconut meat. It still shot my sugar up. Other people, it's not problematic. For me, if it's kefir, if it's fermented, I don't have a problem with it. So you might have people test that out. Okay, let me see.
This is Beverly, and I can tell you I looked through the majority of the people are asking for you to postpone the call.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Overwhelmingly, yeah.
Yeah, good. Because, I tend to feel bad if I suggest that, but then I realize that, people just, it's you want this in more bite-sized pieces that you can absorb. And I think that once you've been through the Before Be Gone program, having an outline and a whole protocol for you to create your own is going to make so much more sense. So thank you for supporting that, and we'll just postpone it. And because 3 calls next week would be a bit much, wouldn't it? And I really invite you to come to the 9th call with Nina, because Nina's really good at helping you to really talk to people in a very loving, engaging way and help them to see the benefit of this. Because I know when you're starting to build your practice, it's really hard. And you go, oh, this is so exciting. And you start talking to people and they just look at you like, huh? And if you have a focus and a way of presenting this and talking to people about it to engage them, it's going to be really great. So she gives you that system, that protocol, and then you're ready to take on. You'll go through the Before Be Gone modules, and then I'll share with you what was my thought process in putting this together. What could be your thought process in presenting it and helping you to have the verbiage that you can use to explain it to people, which you may not be doing it with groups. You're going to do it with one-on-one to start, and I highly recommend that you do it one-on-one to start, because if you don't and you don't have that experience under your belt, it's going to be challenging to do it with a group, very challenging. So you'll see how I do it with the group, and you can aspire to that, and you can even apply to eventually when we open it up where we're going to offer a service to people who are going through it to have a coach, and it'll be people who are certified through the insulin resistance practitioner program where we'll hire you to help coach people through it. But I want you to get some experience doing this with people one-on-one before you would go before a group. Absolutely. So are there any other questions there that I didn't cover? So I know some of the questions might have come in as I was speaking, and some of them might have come in before I covered it in the presentation.
Yeah, and luckily we did get to most of them, but Victoria asked where I can get slides print out.
Well, we'll do that. I'm away. Right after this call, I will upload the PDF to my website, assuming the server's working, and then I can just put the link. So that could be available, I mean, probably as soon as tomorrow morning if I don't get to it tonight.
Patricia asks, we'll do that. Patricia asks if I do spinning, which includes births at 7 a.m., that would be a proper way to eat after exercise, or could I eat a bit before exercise?
Yeah, that's a great question, because sometimes the timing rules conflict, don't they, right? You want to get up and exercise first thing in the morning, but then when do you eat? And do you wait? So you can't satisfy all of the rules at the same time. And sometimes that happens, unless you move your exercise to later in the day. So if you want to exercise in the morning, sometimes what I have people do is have a little bit of just protein powder before they go exercise, and that way that'll hold them off so that they can wait an hour and a half after they finish the exercise and for their eating, and then they've had that protein within the hour of waking up so that they can set their boundaries. And the protein powder is less likely to, it's not going to do much to the insulin, right, if you just do the protein powder without the carbs. So that's a great question. I like that question, Patricia.
Yeah, and so then when you get finished with your, say you do a 30 or 45 or even an hour workout at that point, you would be able to do that right after taking the protein, right?
And then wait an hour and a half after that exercise before you have another meal.
Okay.
So it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be like the same 4-hour spacing. So you're going to break some of the rules when you want to exercise first thing in the morning, but it's no big deal.
Okay.
Just if you do it right. If you have a donut before you go, and when you come back, you're in trouble.
Oh, I hope we're not eating donuts in this program.
I hope we're beyond that. But the people you're working with are still going to be, believe me.
That's true.
Even some of the ones that think they're eating healthily. Well, I got the donut at the health food store, and it's gluten-free.
And it didn't have chocolate coating on it, you know?
Yeah,
Or I picked it off.
I picked off the chocolate. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Patricia asks,
any others?
There are people that think that's a healthy option.
Oh, I know. So, any other questions? I want to respect everybody's time, and just I want to get the questions done. And if we can, and if not, if we can do it in 5 minutes, great. And then whatever's left after 5 minutes, I'll just make sure that we somehow get it all. Maybe tomorrow or the next day, I'll just record a little addendum with the answers to the rest of the questions.
Okay. All right. Well, we can either there's just like the fact Patricia asked regarding the fact that the body needs protein with carb. Is it the opposite of the dissociation of food combining diet that says eat your protein with veggies and no protein with carbs?
Right. I'm not saying you should eat your protein with carbs. I'm saying you're avoiding them. So when I say carbs, I mean your vegetables. Vegetable carb is different. Vegetables have carbs in them, right? But they're not high glycemic carbs. They're not going to raise your blood sugar. So that's what I mean. The protein with the greens with the fat is a good breakfast, but protein with carb is not a good breakfast. No.
Like avoiding things like corn and butternut squash, sweet potatoes, peas, things like that. That's the kind of starchy that you would probably want to avoid with your protein.
No, not necessarily, because those are complex foods. Those have protein in them. Some people need to avoid those during the 30-day metabolic reset. They're very sensitive to those. It's going to be a matter of whether that works, right?
Okay.
So, yeah, that's not necessarily something you want to eat like you want to sit down and have steak and potatoes, because that's actually a bad combination. They found that what happens is that the insulin levels go actually higher when you combine the meat with the potatoes than they do without. And I've got some of those studies on the site. Well, there will be when I put them up there. So it's really, you've got to have them test. It's really important to test. And if they're not willing to test, then those kinds of starchy proteins, which is what I would call them, although some of them, butternut squash is not high in protein, but peas and things like that, they should be avoided for those 30 days if they're not willing to test it and see. A lot of people do great with lentils and peas. Other people don't.
Right. And I noticed this on one of your slides too, and someone caught it. I was going to ask you on the slide 33. It is said to, it said on the slide to do the birth 2 hours before eating, and you said to do the 2 hours after eating. Which one is good?
Both.
Okay, good. And
yeah.
You've already answered about the coconut juice, and I think we're almost there. Bayari said, question, hello, I thank you. I think I heard you mention it can be helpful if you have carbs to have it with some complete protein. If a client asks, isn't that against food combining? And you really just...
No, I just covered that. No, I didn't say that at all. Sorry if that was misunderstood.
Yeah, and the last thing with refreshing the page, and we're done. My glucose levels, this is Terry from Fairview. Glucose levels are pretty good. One consistent issue is that when I wake up every night at 3 a.m. and feel very awake until 6, then crash. Do you know what might be causing this?
Well, there's a lot of possibilities, but I would say she could have a cortisol issue, right? She may, I would, and this is something you ask your patients, and it's something to just tread, you know, gently with, but a lot of people have had some sort of abuse or trauma that's happened in the middle of the night, and they typically wake up, or they did as a child or teenager, and then their cycle gets imprinted in their brain and that cortisol levels go up. So I would, one of the things I would do to try to analyze that would be to get an adrenal stress index test and test it in the middle of the night upon awakening. So get one. If you go to the site, my site, drritamarie.com/lab testing, I have one listed there, and there's two. There's one is the straight ASI, but the other one is the ASI for people with sleep problems. And then you test it when you wake up. That could be an issue. So that's a whole. We go through that in a little bit more detail in the adrenal program.
Great. And that's all the questions that were typed in. And there's two hands up. And if you just want to take them, we could be done.
Okay, perfect. So who do we have?
We have Eleanor, I guess, a Lochter, right, from Perrine, Florida?
Yes, you do.
Hi. Hello. Hi, I know it's late. Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, I'll try to be quick because I know it's late. But I did have a gentleman that agreed to start the program, and the first day he complained before dinner about being lightheaded and getting a headache. And he's a meat eater, so I allowed him to have chicken. He had chicken and kale that night. And that night his blood shot up at the 45-minute mark to 156.
On meat and kale?
Just small piece of chicken. I told him 3 ounces and kale.
Oof. Is this a diabetic?
Well, he was the 120 that I was talking about earlier. I mean, the fact that he grilled the chicken, I mean, if he used olive oil or anything like that, can anything
shouldn't.
Like that have, it shouldn't impact it. So why in the world?
Thing. You're going to see a lot of those, like, what the heck and why and all that. And when they're so dysregulated, it sometimes you can't explain it. So I would see if it happens again every time he eats that combination, and you're sure he wasn't putting anything else in there.
No, he wasn't, yeah.
Fed beef? Was it grain-fed beef, maybe?
It was chicken, and it was organic chicken. And the only, when he did his blood testing, the main thing that shot him up into the 150 range was flour, pizza, and corn muffin. You know,
yeah,
so
that's
I would
not
say he's got a flour thing going on, but I don't. I can't understand why protein and greens would do it.
Generally, it doesn't. So it might have been the stress response from having had his blood sugar go low. You know, that he was feeling like lightheaded. So you might just tell him to have, you know, the snack attack strategy?
Okay.
Go through that and give him something like, okay, don't let yourself get to that lightheaded, jittery. If you get there and you can't make it to the full to dinner, have one of these things. You know, have a piece of avocado or some chia seeds or some green powder or protein powder or something to hold that off and see.
Oh.
I think it might have been a stress response.
Okay, yeah, because especially since he had a headache and a but he started off before the meal, he was at 90.
That's
what surprised me. He started at 90. At 15, he was 131, 153, 156, 157. 2 hours later, he was 158.
Jeez. Did you ask him what kind of music or entertainment or whether he was reading the newspaper or watching TV while he ate?
No, I didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I would monitor it. Just keep an eye on it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's that's a hard one to explain.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And
all right,
then
we have
last,
one more. Casey,
yeah, one more. There we go. And her line is open.
It's
Hi, Casey.
Hi, Rita Marie. I hope you're feeling better.
I am. I actually was able to touch my ear today with no problem. So
nice.
I was just celebrating that one.
Nice. I have a couple of quick questions. One is, when we signed up for the program, there was the opportunity to have another person do the program with us, and I can't remember what that was for and when that starts and when should we have a second person do the program.
Well, that's before Be Gone program, so not this program, but excuse me one second. Water. That was for the Before Be Gone, and I said at the beginning, I don't know if you were on, but I said at the beginning, I wasn't sure that Stacy was working on getting that email out to and tell you how to get your person signed up. So we're basically going to be announcing to the public the Before Be Gone program and opening registration on Thursday, this coming Thursday. And
okay.
You're going to get a link that's going to say, or, yeah, something that you're going to send your person that says click here, and they're going to give us their name and email address, and then we're going to ship them, once registration opens, we're going to ship them a very special order form that allows them to join the program for free.
Got it. Okay.
Be as simple as that. So all you'll need to do is put your their name and email address so that we can ship them the information, and then they're going to just have to give your name when they sign up. So, you know, we don't want you sending it to multiple people. You can only send it to one person.
Of course. So I need to choose my person no later than this coming Thursday and get
you don't have to, but the sooner they get in, the better. Because they'll get access to the site as soon as they sign up, but we'll be keeping registration open until at least the following Thursday, so
got
the 10th.
Next question I have is, remember I had held off on doing the saliva testing. I thought that I had a kit to do it, but I couldn't find it, but I found it. I have the box to do it. I haven't opened the box, but it's from Diagnostics. Are you familiar with them?
Company I use most of the time.
Excellent. Okay, good. So when I get the results back, I will give it to you. The one that it says is WCDTIMHLM Lifestyle Monitor.
What?
I don't know.
Ooh.
That's what it says on the – that's, I guess, what they're testing for. WCDTIMHLM, and then underneath that it says Lifestyle Monitor. I don't know what that means, but
– I don't know what all that is. Usually it just says Adrenal Stress Index.
Okay, I'll make sure that it does the adrenal stress index.
Call the company. They usually have an 800 number in there, and just call them and verify that you have the right kit for what you want to do.
Okay.
All right.
Yes, and I have still not followed through on my commitment to get the glucose meter one step at a time. I'm just doing my best. So I found the saliva test.
Yeah, do it, and when you do it for yourself, and you feel real comfortable, then you're going to feel comfortable teaching it to someone else. You're obviously not going to feel comfortable teaching anybody else about it until you've done it.
Correct.
Yeah. But it's all due time. We learn these things and then we put them into effect. And so, you know, just do it at your own pace. Okay?
Exactly. And I may be one of those people that for the 30-day time that I do it, that I take the most minimal thing, and that's what I eat, and then I may incorporate. I don't know yet. That's not my plan. My plan is to get the glucose meter so that I can learn how to do it, so I can teach others how to do it. So,
if that's your plan, then I'm going to ask you to make a commitment to us that between now and the time that the Before Be Gone officially starts next Thursday, the 10th, that you either go to Walgreens and get one or you go on Amazon and order one. Easy.
Okay. So I just want to tell you that, you know, I lead a 10-day juice cleanse every quarter, and between now and the 10th, I'm leading this juice cleanse. So I have a lot of people that I'm spending time with, and I don't know if I can honor that commitment if I make it, and I don't want to make it if I'm not going to
No, then
it.
Don't. I didn't realize how busy. That's a big commitment. So do it when you're ready. But you had said to me you really wanted to. So that's
I will consider that, and I will consider doing that, okay? But
absolutely. Well, good luck with the juice cleanse. Awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's just a green juice cleanse for 10 days. It's a two-week Course in Mindfulness, the We Juice for Joy experience is what it's called. So, it's a green juice 10-day cleanse. We do it in community, and first day of juicing's tomorrow, and I've got, I think, 12 or 13 people. So, it's
hey,
nice.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thank you. So I want to be able to segue them onto the elimination diet, when I bring them back onto solids. And that's another question I wanted to ask you. What is your philosophy on mono eating?
You know, when people are really have gastric distress, they have a lot of food allergies and you're really having a hard time figuring it out, if you can get them to do it, it can be very helpful. It's not a long-term eating plan by any stretch.
No.
But it can be a great diagnostic tool and a great healing tool. The big issue with that one is compliance. People are almost more willing to give up food entirely than just sit down and eat a meal with just one food.
Well,
it can be very helpful.
I have four people with either GERDs or IBS or, they have some diagnosis with gastric distress. And they are committed. They will do what I say if they transition back from the juices onto solids. I pretty much
say this is
what you do, and they will do it. So,
perfect.
So then you have them do it.
You can use the guidelines that I gave you for reintroducing foods. That's something that I've used for a long time, or whatever you like to use. But it's really important that they monitor. Because the tendency for people coming off any kind of cleanse is it's like everything they see in sight they want to eat.
Yes. So that's where this program is supporting what I'm teaching them in terms of reintroducing and where to go and what's a good maintenance, way to maintain. So
Absolutely.
I teach this class every quarter, and I have people who come back and do it with us every quarter. So it's good. And we advocate the once a week juice cleanse also.
Yeah.
Who want to do it.
For people who want to and can do it, yep.
Yes, awesome. Yes. Thank you.
Right. Well, thanks for sharing, and good luck with that. Enjoy it, and then when you're ready to get your glucose meter, you will.
Exactly, and I will.
All right. Well, you take care, everybody. Just kind of go out and enjoy. Make sure you're on the calls next week. Come to the call this Thursday and see how I introduce it and overview it to people and see what the response is. Hopefully it'll be favorable. I want to model something positive for you. And then next week we'll start, and it'll be a great experience. And come to Nina's call next, I think it's Wednesday, when we do that, the enrollment conversation one.
Rita Marie, okay. Is there an affiliate program?
Yeah, go to drritamarie.com, and then up in the right-hand corner at the top, it should say affiliate sign up. And please, if you're going to send people to me, please use the affiliate link. You might as well get compensated.
Excellent.
Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and then we will we'll talk to you soon. And be sure to keep in mind who you're going to invite if that was one of the bonuses you got. And we'll be in touch via email to tell you exactly how to do that. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye now.
Bye, everyone.
The moderator has left the conference.
Thank you.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.